chance. We'll have the latest news, weather and papers in a minute. And then the spring series of Open Country begins in Cambridgeshire. Martha Carney will be celebrating the humble daffodil. That's in a few minutes. On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 4th of April. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. Iran and the US are racing to find the missing crew member of a downed American fighter jet. Tehran says it shot down the F-15 over the southwest of the country yesterday and that soldiers are now combing the area. US officials have told the BBC's partner network CBS News that the other person in the aircraft has been rescued. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalawashow reports from Washington.
This is the first known case of a US military aircraft being shut down over Iran during this war. Iran's Revolutionary Guard is now said to have sealed off a huge area and begun a search for the missing US service personnel, turning this into a high-stakes race on the ground between the two adversaries. In a further blow to Washington, Iran claims to have shot down a second US warplane. US media say the A-10 Warthog was targeted near the Strait of Hormuz during a search and rescue mission for the first downed aircraft. The pilot ejected and was rescued.
The Metropolitan Police has removed five officers from frontline duties after a bag of guns issued by the force was reportedly left outside the home of the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan. Scotland Yard said it believed the weapons were misplaced. Greg McKenzie reports.
A bag containing Metropolitan Police firearms, reportedly including a submachine gun, a taser and ammunition, has been recovered after being found on a South London street. A local man, Jordan Griffiths, said his partner discovered the bag by the curb on Tuesday evening. He told the Sun newspaper he was shocked by its contents and immediately contacted police. The Metropolitan Police say the five officers have been removed from frontline duties and the force says an urgent internal review is now underway. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London described it as a very serious incident.
Three people have been charged after an arson attack destroyed four ambulances in northwest London. The vehicles belonging to a Jewish charity were set on fire in Golders Green. More details from our special correspondent Lucy Manning.
The Crown Prosecution Service said it had charged 20-year-old Hamza Iqbal, 19-year-old Rayhan Khan and a 17-year-old who can't be named for legal reasons with arson, with intent to damage property and being reckless as to whether life would be endangered. The ambulances were set on fire last week in the grounds of a synagogue car park. The Metropolitan Police says Hamza Iqbal and Rayhan Khan are British nationals from Leyton, and the unnamed 17-year-old is a dual British Pakistani national from Walthamstow.
The NASUWT Teaching Union has warned there's a masculinity crisis brewing in schools. A survey of 5,000 of its members suggests almost a quarter of female teachers face misogyny from pupils in the past year. The government says it's giving teachers resources to spot and tackle misogynistic beliefs. Astronauts on NASA's Artemis 2 mission have sent back the most detailed pictures yet of their journey to the moon, including a stunning image of the Earth that's been named Hello World. Travelling at about 24,000 miles an hour, the Orion spacecraft is now halfway to the moon and on course to fly around it on Monday evening. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh is following the mission from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
In the latest image sent back by the Artemis 2 crew, the entire Earth hangs luminous in the blackness of space. Deep blue oceans, swirling white clouds and a bright atmosphere give it the appearance of a shimmering jewelled marble. It's an echo of the first colour photograph of Earth taken by the astronauts of Apollo 8 in 1968, an image that provided a moment of hope and optimism to a divided and war-torn world. And perhaps the new picture might have the same effect.
That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute, but first, Louise Lee is here with today's weather.
Good morning. It's not a bad start to our Easter weekend. In fact, early birds will be greeted to some lovely sunshine across eastern Scotland and eastern half of the UK. It will cloud over and is clouding over quite quickly from the west. And yes, there's going to be a little bit of drizzly rain already across southwest England and parts of Wales, and that'll be drifting its way steadily north. But if you keep the sunshine, well, it will feel pleasantly mild out there with highs of 16 degrees. Now, Scotland, a few scattered showers around at the moment. Scotland, Northern Ireland, and rather cloudy and windy as we go into the afternoon. So winds will strengthen this evening and through the night, and we've got this deepening area of low pressure named Storm Dave by the Met Office. That's going to bring heavy rain, gales or severe gales through the night across Scotland and Northern Ireland in particular, even some mountain snow. It clears away at quite a pace, and then as we move into Easter Sunday, it's going to be a case of sunny spells and blustery showers for all. That's your weather.
Thanks, Louise. Now let's take a look at the papers. And the Daily Mail calls the race between the US and Iran to find the missing crew member of a downed American jet a head-to-head competition between the warring sides. The paper says the images of debris from the plane are a major propaganda boost for the Iranian regime. According to The Guardian, aviation experts believe the wreckage is from the aircraft that's part of a US squadron based in Britain. The Daily Telegraph says if the aircraft flew from the UK, it may raise difficult questions for Keir Starmer, who said the US can use bases on British soil only for defensive operations. The Times says as long as the crew member is unaccounted for, Trump's war in Iran will be overshadowed by concerns about their fate. The FT Weekend carries a warning that diesel prices in the UK could hit £2 a litre within days. It says the wholesale cost of the fuel has surged to a four-year high. Separately, the Daily Mirror says fat cats, running four of Britain's biggest energy industry giants, have seen the value of their shareholdings jump since before the war. The paper says Centrica and Shell declined to comment, while Harbour and BP did not respond. The Eye Weekend says more than 500 members of the British Armed Forces stationed at sensitive military sites have revealed their locations on the fitness tracking app Strava. The paper says runners at one of the UK-US bases even jokingly called their route security breach. Strava was approached for comment. The Ministry of Defence said it took the security of personnel very seriously and kept guidance under constant review. And the Daily Express says it's marmalade madness that the British breakfast favourite could be rebranded as part of a deal with the EU. It says Labour's agreement on food has been called completely bonkers. The government insists British marmalade is not changing and that its agreement with Brussels supports businesses by removing red tape. And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, Martha Carney's in Cambridgeshire to celebrate the start of the spring series of Open Country.
Paul, to anyone, have we got both checkpoints covered at the moment? Over.
Checkpoint Charlie, Paul.
This may sound a bit like a military operation, but actually, I've come to a daffodil festival. And I'm standing next to a man with a high-vis jacket, and on the back it's written, The Boss. So my great journalistic powers are telling me that, Paul Earnshaw, you might be in charge of this.
Yeah, I'm Paul. I'm chair of the Triplo Daffodil Weekend. It's a huge event. We've got 12,000 visitors turning up. There's only 350 of us in the village, so welcome to Triplo.
We're standing on, I guess, the main street now. We're surrounded by lots of different stalls. I think there's going to be folk music, lots of things starting up. But what's the connection between daffodils and Triplo?
Well, it all started back in 1968. We were raising money for the church roof, and the guys that were organising it went up onto the church roof and they looked out and they thought, we've got a few daffodils around here. Let's theme it around daffodils. And we've been doing it ever since.
And does that mean different people in the village are planting more daffodils?
Yeah, Tom planted 20,000 daffodils this year for our event, and we have about 500,000 in flower at the moment.
Well, let's go for a little walk round and you can show me some of the things that are happening. Some hay bales over there.
Yeah, so enormous amount of stuff going on over the weekend. It's a village fete, but it's a village fete that has become supersized. So it's just everything you'd expect. Later on, we'll have horse and cart rides coming up and down the village. Four music stages that we've got running. artisan food stalls, children's entertainment.
Eat your heart out, Glastonbury.
Reenactors, randomly as we walk along, there's a Roman just trying to buy a coffee. Shall we wander into the smithy and see what the blacksmith is up to? But as we're doing that, have a look on the right there. You can see our village sign surrounded by a daffodil variety called Triplo Gold, and you only see Triplo Gold in the village of Triplo. It's unique to our village.
These are so pretty. They've got a really dense heart to them, and it goes to a deeper, almost an orange colour in the centre, doesn't it?
That's a variety called Madam Speaker, which is in honour of one of our much-loved residents, Betty Boothroyd, who lived in the village.
A lovely woman. I interviewed her many times.
Yeah, and we've got all sorts of daffodils here, from super early varieties. We had daffodils in flower on Christmas Day, through to the really late ones like Pheasant's Eye, which won't come into flower until April, probably still be flowering in May.
Well, I can hear some banging, clatter of metal going on. Let's investigate.
Hello there.
Hiya. Wow, quite a fire there. And it's glowing, ready orange as he's banging it into place on his anvil, I guess.
Yep, on the anvil.
And is this still a working smithy?
Not yet. We keep asking. We want it to be a working smithy because there aren't many hand bellows forges left in the UK still working as active forges. So to lose this piece of history would be terrible. So we are petitioning to try to get it open.
While we're here, can I just introduce you to Jeff Axe, a long-term resident of the village?
Hi.
Hi, Jeff. How long have you been working on the Daffodil Festival and how many years?
Oh, since about 87. You know, it's changed dramatically from the time I started.
And what do you think it means for the people in the village?
Everybody gets together, the volunteers, there's over 400 here. They come in from other villages and, you know, it's just a great time.
Paul to Tom, are you anywhere near yet? Over.
I'm bloody running, Paul, I'm bloody running.
Go on, Tom, pull your finger out.
Yeah, I'm just at the caravan, I'll be there in 2 seconds.
He's not at the caravan, because that's the caravan. That's our daffodil rapid response unit, in case there's a daffodil-related emergency. We've never had one yet, but, you know, it's there just in case.
I suppose in case somebody tries to eat one, because they are poisonous.
They are poisonous, and that's actually sort of one of the historic things about the daffodil, that it's not actually a native British flower. It was brought into Britain by the Romans, and actually the Roman soldiers used to carry daffodil bulbs in their backpacks, and they'd take it as if they were caught by the barbarians, they'd take it as a sort of suicide pill. That's the story.
That's the story.
Let me introduce you to Tom Harvey.
I've been hearing your nickname's Daffodil, Tom.
Yes.
There must be a reason for that.
Yeah, lots of daffodils. For around 2-3 years now, we've just been planting. The first year was around 57,000, and then this year was around 20,000, and previous was 40-odd thousand, so...
I mean, I love it when I've planted daffodils, and it's in the autumn, and you kind of forget about them, and then suddenly they're here.
Yeah, my kids also help me do it, so when they grow up, they're going to be walking around the village going, oh, we planted them, which is really nice. They all work very hard, so very proud family.
So, coming into the village hall, the centre of the operation here, you can see how many homemade cakes are just about to be dished up.
Honestly, the smells are so good.
A week before it, when the village shop runs out of flour, we have to order an extra flour because everyone's making homemade cakes and all this sort of stuff. And we'll be serving probably about 10,000 cups of tea over the course of the weekend.
Come and say hello. You're wandering around with a bright green face as if this is a completely normal thing. Are you a green man?
No.
But you've got a very good bumblebee waistcoat on, which I definitely approve of.
So I'm a member of Gog Magog Molly.
You're going to have to tell me what that is.
So Molly dancing is the Cambridgeshire and Fenland tradition of Morris dancing.
And you're going to be dancing later?
We're dancing at 12 outside the pub.
Well, best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Later
a man
on.
In a medieval cloak, yep. Disappearing into the porcelain.
Yep. Later on Sunday, for reasons that now escape me, we've got the Civil War reenactors doing YMCA on the main stage. Honestly,
Vicar of Dibley, it's a documentary. It's not a comedy programme. I just have to spend most of my time stopping it turning into Midsummer Murders, but that's...
Looking through here, and you've got a kind of weeping willow, you've got the village pond, and then there's daffodils planted on the verge of the road. But actually, as far as the eye can see, right through into that woodland.
Yes, it's beautiful, this, isn't it? And actually, you're just looking at Betty Boothroyd's garden. We haven't got any of the Madam Speaker on show in this one, but we can see here, this is King Alfred. That one is Mount Hood. Pheasant Eye, and I'm surprised to see that out already. That's quite an old variety, actually. All daffodils are beautiful. If you're looking for a sort of standard yellow daffodil that's very reliable, you go after the King Alfred or the Dutch Master. If you want a smaller one, the classic tete-a-tete is lovely for that.
Because they don't blow over in the wind, do they?
They're robust. Anywhere where grass grows, daffodils will grow, is sort of like the rule that we apply to that. And then you have my favourite daffodil, which is actually a variety called Jetfire. And it's what's called a recurvous daffodil because its petals point backwards. And it always has a sort of slightly surprised look to it as it pops up. It just looks lovely.
Have you any idea how many daffodils there are in Triplow?
Yeah, so I actually counted them and we think we've got about 500,000. But the daffodils grow really well round here because we are near Saffron Walden. And Saffron Walden got its name from saffron, which comes from crocuses.
Yeah.
Yeah, and crocuses and daffodils are closely related species, and we're actually in what's called the Saffron Triangle here, so that's one of the reasons we got so many daffodils. Daffodils tend to like to struggle a little bit. They don't want bad soil, but actually, you know, something that's too rich, they go a bit crazy, they go a bit mad, and then they sort of die back in it a year or two later.
Lots of yellow bunting out.
Johnny does all the bunting and he's absolutely obsessed with getting the swag. He calls it the swag correct. You think I'm boring about daffodils, you wait till you talk to Johnny about bunting.
It's lovely coming up the path now, seeing the church against the bright blue sky.
Yeah, we've been superbly lucky with the weather this year. This is a good one. We've had all sorts. We've had it frozen. We've had wind, we've had rain. Everyone just pushes on through. It's lovely to see how the British people actually just come and enjoy themselves in the countryside.
Oh, it's some beautiful flower arrangements here. Oh, the smell of the lilies is just gorgeous.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Lovely spring smell. But all the flowers are, well, most of them are grown in the village, so you can see that beautiful forsythia there. So on the Thursday before the daffodil weekend, everybody comes up here and spends the morning, actually the day, arranging all of these different flower arrangements. And the day before, everybody picks greenery from their gardens. There's a lovely atmosphere up here in the couple of days before.
This is a big horse, isn't it?
Yeah. His name is Gifford.
Gifford?
Gifford. He's 18
big,
pounds.
Isn't he? He's a
and
big
he weighs
horse.
1 ton, 120 kilos.
Is he a Suffolk Punch?
He's a purebred, yeah. You can tell a Suffolk because there's only one colour and it's a ginger.
It's a popular ride, isn't it?
Oh, it's every year. I've been coming the last 5 years. And it's been busy every year like this, yeah.
Why do you think people like traditional things like this?
I think people just start to realise that, you know, all modern is not good sometimes.
You can get a feeling nowadays that we're separated, aren't we? We're on our phones or we're in our own little boxes. And a day like this feels very different, doesn't it?
This is how humans should live, is always what I think. I mean, there's no screens, people aren't on their phones because we haven't really got very good mobile reception here. And you start to see people having a nice time, helping each other, being friendly, and you realise there probably is hope for humanity.
Well, you can really hear the enthusiasm of the people who love daffodils so much in Triplow, but I want to find out more about this flower which seems so familiar to us. I've come about 20 minutes away to the Cambridge University Botanic Garden and I've come to meet Angela Cano, and you're deputy curator here, aren't you?
I am.
And just describe to me what we're standing in front of.
So we are here at the systematic beds, which is a large portion of the botanic garden, where we have in separate beds plant families. And so we have here next to us the family where the narcissus or daffodils are classified. So narcissus is the scientific name of daffodils, and they are classified into the Amaryllidaceae family. It's a large group, but as you can see, there are loads of different beds around you with other families, and they all belong to a large lineage of plants called the monocots.
Okay, now just below us, I recognize these because I have them in my garden. Narcissus, pseudo-narcissus, and sometimes that's people right. talk about them as a wild daffodil, and they're very small and very delicate with pale, pale petals.
So there are about 50 to 80 species, natural biological species in the genus, most of them in Portugal and Spain, but we do have one that is native to the UK, which is Narcissus pseudo-narcissus, as you said.
And so this is genuinely native, because people talk about daffodils being brought here by the Romans, but these were here first.
Some people think that it was introduced very early, but it's not very clear.
And it's interesting that they're from the genus Narcissus, because we talk about narcissi, don't we, as a different kind of flower.
So you know Narcissus is related to the word narcissist, and it comes from that Greek myth where there was this god that saw his image in the water and he fell in love with his image and then fell in the water and died. One of the reasons people think these are called narcissus, because the flowers normally are hanging as if they were looking at their reflection in the water, and they are very beautiful. So that make them quite royal, right? But actually, Linné, who was a botanist who actually named the plant...
Of the very famous Swedish
exactly,
Carl Linné.
Exactly, yeah. That very famous botanist. He attributed the name not to the Narcissus myth, but to a Greek word that is narche, which means numbness. And he thinks it's because some of the bulbs in some of the species, when you eat them, they give you this numbness.
So just behind the lovely, pale, wild daffodils, what are the other small ones over here in this corner?
It says Narcissus tasseta. And this is actually a cultivar. And this is something we haven't spoken about. I said that there are about 50 to 80 biological species in this genus, but actually man has transformed this into a wonderful diversity of more than 30,000 cultivars. So by crossing them and selecting them, they've created all these different cultivars, and this one is called Narcissus tasseta canaliculatus.
They're so pretty. I've got to get up close to them and have a look, because they're so tiny. And the centre is a bright, bright yellow, and then the pale pushing backwards. You've got lots of daffodils growing in the grass as well.
Exactly, and that's, I think, why people came so many to the garden today to look at that wonderful blossoming of the narcissus and of the daffodils.
We've come inside now, away from the glorious spring sunshine, but for a purpose, because we're inside the herbarium. And this is kind of like a library of plants in a way, isn't it?
Exactly. They were collected and then they were pressed and dried and then mounted in very special paper that is acid-free, so it can last for a long time. And what you're seeing here are two types of specimens. This one on the left was collected by Henslow, who was the founder of the botanic garden and a person who really revolutionized science. He was Darwin's mentor, and you can see in his specimen how he has the actual plant material, but also wonderful drawings that he did himself to teach about what we call the morphology of a plant. So that's how every part of the plant is called.
And you can see how old they are, because you've got the drawing with the bright yellow daffodil, and then on the page these pressed brown faded flowers.
So here we see in the drawing, but also in the specimen, how these plants have bulbs, They are what we say geophytes. These are plants that can survive under the ground. Geo means earth. So they can survive during the hard seasons, either very dry or very cold seasons.
And this one looks like you cut an onion in half.
Exactly, and that's because these are very close relative to onions.
So the life cycle of daffodils isn't solely through bulbs, it's through seeds as well, is it?
Exactly, it's both. So when they do it through bulbs, we call that asexual reproduction. It's actually a clone. The bulb is a clone of the mother plant, but it's exactly the same genetic content as the plant.
I was wondering whether they've got a weapon in the survival of the fittest, because they're poisonous, aren't they? And they definitely survive in my garden when an awful lot gets eaten by either muntjac or rabbits.
They have this deer deterrent molecule in the leaves, which is called calcium oxalate.
I did hear a story that Roman soldiers kept them as a sort of suicide pill.
If you would eat one of these bulbs today, you would get a slightly numb, maybe, slightly sick, but it wouldn't kill you as you would. It would, like, a pill of cyanide, definitely not.
And I know when people study plants, they're often looking to see if there's any application that can be used in medicine. Is that true of daffodils?
It is true. So in daffodils, you can find a molecule called galantamine, which is now used to treat Alzheimer's disease. And in Wales, there are growing narcissus to extract the galantamine from them.
Daffodils that come before the swallow dares and take the winds of March with beauty. That was Shakespeare in A Winter's Tale. So what were daffodils like in his day? Well, I've come to Anglesey Abbey, not so far away from Triplow, National Trust property, to find out a bit more about Tudor daffodils and the flowers of Britain's past. And I'm with David Jordan, who's senior gardener at Anglesey Abbey. And David, we're just surrounded by daffodils.
Absolutely, yes. We have a massive display of a variety called Rheinwald's Early Sensation. And there's 20,000 in this small space, but we've got loads more different varieties around the garden that you can see, even ones that start flowering in May. So we have a very long period of flowering in the garden.
And what kind of varieties do you have?
About 60 in total. They range from ones that Reverend Engelhart brought.
He was a
very keen daffodil man, and I think it's through him that we found out that they started bringing the red colour into daffodils. So the ones with the orange trumpets and the pink trumpets, they all come from one type of daffodil. It's called the poeticus, the poet's daffodil.
Oh, lovely.
Or pheasant's eye. Yeah.
What's the oldest variety that you've got here?
The oldest one we've got is one we think is Tudor, so that's a nice link to Shakespeare. And it's one called Telemonius Plenus, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's also sold under the name of Von Sion, so that's a bit easier to say.
Can we go and see some?
Absolutely. They're not far from here. Now, species are the ones that you find in the wild, the ones that are an isolated group, and they interbreed with each other, and they come up true every time. They're what's known as promiscuous. They're insect pollinated, and they don't care where the pollen's coming from. As long as they're getting the pollen into the flower, they'll create a seed. They'll cross-pollinate readily, and then you end up with these little hybrids. And people have been in the past collecting pollen from one and then pollinating later flowering ones to get a mixture. So of the 74 species that there are in the world, there's now about 32,500 varieties named, which is mind-blowing.
I suppose it just shows how people love this flower so much that they've Absolutely. Wanted to create all the different varieties.
Absolutely.
So we've got Early Sensation on the right, yeah. And then we've got much paler ones on our left, haven't we?
Yeah, and that's one called Early Bride, and that's a good doer. And we've got a mixture under that beech tree there, which are some of the Engelhart varieties as well. And this one is a colour-changing variety. It starts off with the yellow trumpet, and the trumpet turns to pink as it gets older.
How lovely. What's that?
That's called Stony Brook. So this is the one called Telemonius Plenus, or Van Sion. And It is a full double, so it has multiple numbers of outer tepals, and the corona is multiple as well. So when it's in full flower, this one's going over slightly because it's been nice and warm.
I'm going to use a technical term here, but it's really frilly, isn't it?
Yes, as you say, Martha, it's a very frilly daffodil. It's been around for a long while, since Tudor times.
How do we know it dates back that far?
Probably something like Gerard's Herbal. He was one of the first people to write a history of what plants were in the country at the time.
So it's like looking at a history of the countryside in a way, isn't it? Through these spring flowers.
Absolutely.
Back in Triplow, the first day of the Daffodil Festival is beginning to wind down. People are leaving, laden down with bags of plants and other goodies. The beer tent, however, is still doing a pretty good business, and that's where I've caught up with Paul Earnshaw. Well, you've earned your pint.
I have, yeah, and you're keeping me from it.
So how's the day gone?
It's been really, really good. The sun has shone. I'm a bit sunburnt. Lots of our visitors are sunburnt, but everyone's smiling. Everyone's had a good time. We're all feeling good about being British and being human.
Do you think that's the point of the festival, then?
I think it is. The Daffodil Weekend has three pillars, which is our visitors must have a good time, the village must have a good time and pull together as a community, and then if we happen to make some money on top of that, that's a good result. The other thing is that we've just been through a long, cold, dark winter, and now we've got beautiful golden daffodils coming through, so maybe there is some hope.
I think you're right. I think that's what I really love about daffodils, and what I've seen of your festival as well. It's bringing people together. There's that spirit of optimism that there is a spring.
Open Country was presented by Martha Carley, and the producer was Helen Linnard. And there's more about daffodils in Farming Today this week in a minute here on Radio 4. But first, with a word about Tuesday night's 6:30 comedy, here's Sue Perkins.
Nature isn't just beautiful, it's downright eccentric.
It's basically a woodlouse, but it's a tongue-eating louse.
There we go. Join me and a panel of funny, fascinating guests as we share stories, surprises and a few strange specimens. Rob, has this made you more or less a fan of crabs?
Well, I want to eat one now to see if I can help.
I wouldn't advise eating them. They do absorb heavy metals, got microplastics going on.
I'm not hearing anything I don't like.
The new series of Nature Table with me, Sue Perkins. Tuesday nights, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The Today programme is at 7 o'clock here on Radio 4, but first it's time for Farming Today this week with Kaz Graham.
Good morning. This week, ripples from conflict in the Middle East are felt in UK ports. The fishing industry is asking the government for help with fuel costs.
If the price rises to a point where it's no longer economical for a boat to go to sea, that vessel's going to be tied up.
Warnings that animal welfare is at risk on some Scottish islands because of widespread disruption to ferry services.
People are running out of sea, and it's the time of year when animals are calving and you're going through a lot more to keep them going, and the weather has been atrocious.
And what a lovely spring sound. It's lambing time and we're learning the ropes with a student vet. But first, if you're driving out in the countryside over the Easter weekend, the chances are you'll see loads of daffodils planted alongside village roads. But beautiful as they may be, they are just ordinary cultivated garden daffs. In a quiet corner of England on the Herefordshire-Gloucestershire border is an area known as the Golden Triangle, where the daffs are just a little bit more authentic. Every spring, around the villages of Kempley and Dimmock, carpets of wild daffodils can still be seen in the fields and woodlands, thanks to carefully managed farming and forestry practices. You can tell they're wild because they're smaller and they have paler yellow petals surrounding a darker yellow trumpet. Our reporter Bob Hockenhull has been to take a look.
I'm standing on the edge of a field which has got some quite steep banks, and those banks are carpeted with thousands of daffodils, which is quite a rare sight in the UK these days. But here, as I say, they're very plentiful, and with me is Martin Brocklehurst, who is an ecologist. Why are they growing here, Martin?
The wild daffodils here are fertile, so they self-seed, they self-populate, and they colonise out into the grassland areas. And they're here because the farmer chooses to leave the land in this state and not to maximise the economic return from the land. Because as soon as you start ploughing, fertilising or spraying with herbicides, then you lose the daffodils. The other issue is if you graze them too soon in the spring, then you graze out the flowers and then they don't self-seed and then the population diminishes over time.
Why do the farmers do this then? Because it must be tempting to get more out of the land by farming it intensively.
I think it's partly about keeping the heritage alive. I mean, there are some grants as well from the Department of Food and Rural Affairs to help farmers maintain a place for wildlife on the farm. And I think it also helps if you're a family farmer rather than a big commercial business, that you want to keep a balance on the farm. So we're very grateful for those farmers in and around Kempley who maintain the daffodil populations where they can on their land.
One of those farmers is Peter Newman.
We're running a slightly different model for our farming, and we're not grazing animals out in the early part of spring, and we're keeping a lot of the ground for hay meadows, so that gives a chance for the daffodils to flower and seed and get ready for the next year before anything comes along and either eats them off or is mown off. That gives it a natural regeneration.
Peter's brother Jeff has established a cider orchard in one field and is keen to preserve the daffodils too.
The daffodils don't affect really what we do here, so they're not really in the way. So it kind of works well with the cider making, because you pick the apples a different time of year, we can let them flower and thrive, and then we can get the grazing animals in after to make sure we've got a decent sort of floor to get the apples and perry for cider.
Another villager, Roger Coombs, has such fond memories of coming to the Golden Triangle as a boy, he decided to move here to live.
We were almost running up to the woods to see the daffs, and we used to pick them and like everyone else did, and take them back to the village and sell them. And then as a teenager, with a couple of other lads, we used to ride down all the way from Minchinhampton, which was quite a long journey. We used to tie broom handles to our bike and hang the bunches on broom handles, take them back and get a few coppers for them. I had the dream of living in this beautiful place.
But Glyn Bennett, who farmed here all his life, knows the harsh realities of modern farming couldn't protect all the daffodils.
Oh, they were fabulous when I was young in the fields, and they used to come out from Birmingham on the train to Dimmock and pick the daffodils, take them back, and I think they used to take them to the hospital or hospitals in Birmingham, some of them anyway. Yes, we ploughed up quite a lot of fields on the farm over the years, and once two or three times, and the daffodils disappear actually on the field. They're still in the hedgerows. We've got hardly any action on the fields now. The only fields are the ones that have got the preservation orders on them, which we don't have on our farm.
Do you think they'll ever come back in the quantities that they were?
No, not on modern farming practices, intensive farming practices, I should say. Yes, they won't come back there, I'm afraid. No.
Well, that's Glyn Bennett with our reporter, Bob Hockenhull. Now, we know livestock emit greenhouse gases, but we also know that the volume of gas is affected by what that livestock eats. A new government-funded study has investigated upland sheep grazing systems to see if some forage or vegetation produces lower emissions. Well, we've been looking into sheep farming this week on Farming Today, so we sent our reporter Sarah Falkingham to a wet and windy Wensleydale to find out more.
Wow. I've just come to a little village outside Leyburn in the Yorkshire Dales National Park, and I'm with Adrian Thorntonberry, a farmer. We're in his pickup and we're heading up onto the moorland.
All right. Are you sorting the early lambers out?
Yeah, fetching some back down and messing about and doing.
Perfect lambing weather.
It's sideways, isn't it?
We've come up onto a moorland top here under Penn Hill, and it's raining, and they're gathering sheep all around us. Adrian, you wanted to do this project looking at how the forage that the Swaledales eat affects their CO2 emissions. How did you first of all go about the project?
We had to put in a bid to innovate to support the cost of doing the measurements of the sheep, because there's only one specialist trailer in the whole country to do these measurements. So we used the two different breeds, the Textal cross and the Swaledales, the native breed, to see whether there was difference between the two breeds on the respective forage types, to see whether there was any difference in greenhouse gas emissions from the native breed on the unimproved land compared with the Texel.
I'm going to bring in Ellie Rayner here from the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, because you pulled the whole project together and you're an ecologist. How did you measure, how do you measure a sheep's emission?
So we use three different field types. We use modified grassland, which is dominated by rye and clover. Then we used a species-rich grassland, which has had no chemical input for at least 30 years. And then we used a moorland habitat, which had heather, sphagnum moss, bilberry. And then I went about doing forage surveys for each of these fields. So I used a quadrat and I did 30 samples across the different field types and identified the species that the sheep might be eating.
Your sheep, you get them into this
These chambers are called portable accumulation chambers, and they were supplied by the Scottish Rural College. And you put the sheep in there. Each sheep goes in for 50 minutes, and on this wagon there is 12 chambers. So you do it in different instalments of 12 sheep. And then there's a probe in there, and that takes emissions every 20 seconds to measure the methane and CO2, and it goes to this little device, and then they can analyse it.
Is this what they're breathing out, or what they're coming up
both.
The other end?
It's what they're farting and what they're burping, but it's mainly the burping end that is the most interest for the project.
And what did you find then?
We found that Swaledale sheep produce less CO2 on moorland habitats.
By how much?
14%
right.
Less CO2 from the moorland habitat, taking to account the weight difference.
And why does it matter that sheep produce less emissions of CO2?
We've got a really, really important landscape here. There's a lot of natural habitat still within this farm landscape, and the key is that we carry on with farming and farmers. We need to find a means to replace the loss of subsidy that we've had. Without that, the future of hill farming is very, very bleak, and we'll lose people from the hills, and once they've gone, they're not coming back.
So is it a case of labelling the lamb as in lower emissions, or is it about offsetting what business does through, you know, how you practice your work?
Well, the corporate social responsibility agenda is all about trying to do things that are better for the planet. And I believe that Swaledale sheep, and this study supports that, using the protein from them is probably a better way, a better protein, than something that's produced off a more intensive type farming system. So we've got to have something where somebody will say, right, we need to support this because it's environmentally good and it's producing multiple benefits for society and for the farming community.
Adrian Thornton-Berry in the Yorkshire Dales. Now, we are well into the swing of lambing season, with nearly 15 million breeding ewes, most having twins and some giving birth to triplets. It is a big job getting all of these lambs safely delivered. Many sheep farmers recruit help, sometimes family or vet students, and sometimes just people who are interested and want to learn. They'll often be matched up through something called the Lambing List, which is an online site set up by the National Sheep Association. Sally Challoner met up with one farmer in Wales who successfully recruited a first-year vet student.
And then what's the other thing we need to check, Anna?
Well, I'll check the ewe's teats now for any mastitis. But she seems to be good, so plenty of milk.
Gwyn Johnson is the fourth generation at Maysbach Farm near Pontypridd in South Wales. He has 500 ewes to lamb and enjoys teaching the helpers he recruits through the Lambing List.
I always advertise that I'm not necessarily looking for people who've got masses of experience.
Because you can teach that.
Yeah, because I quite like teaching the students if they're keen to learn. They get quite a well-rounded experience when they come here. So like Anna now, hopefully by the end of her time with us, she'll be able to lamb ewes very confidently, whether they're backwards mixed up or all that, catch ewes confidently, ring lambs, tube lambs, milk ewes, tag. Basically, I think that's the majority of it, really.
So, well, let's meet your student, Anna.
Anna Brooks. I'm from Pontypridd as well, and I've just finished my first year at vet school at the University of Nottingham.
So you've been here 2 days so far?
I think my third day.
So what have you done so far?
Well, pretty much everything already. A lot of move-in sheep, so that's been good to gain some like animal handling experience. Been ringing lambs, tube feeding.
Talk me through ringing, just for people that don't know.
So we've been castrating and tail docking. just with the little rubber band.
About a couple of days old.
Yeah, they have to be under a week.
How are you finding it?
Yeah, I'm finding it really good. I've never done lambing before, but really enjoying it. Gwyn's been a great teacher, so I'm learning lots.
And what are you going to do when you finish? How many more years have you got?
I've got another 4 years, so I'm not sure what I'd like to do yet, but being a farm vet is a possibility.
And you've got another one, haven't you, Gwyn? Another student coming along?
Yeah, so I also get contacted by prospective vet students who are still in school as well. Obviously, because they're still in school, they can only really limit their time to sort of weekends and just a few hours on a weekend just to get a little bit of experience. And I'm quite open to that because I think everyone's got to start somewhere and get experience somehow, haven't they, really?
It's going to look great on their CV as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Do you do it every year, the lambing list?
We do, yeah. Yeah, we do it every year.
What else would you do, I suppose?
I think the good thing with a lambing list is you are targeting your audience more so. You could put an advert, you know, locally, maybe in the press or on Facebook even, I've seen people do. And I think you just get any Tom, Dick and Harry just apply in. And I also do think that maybe people don't realise that we are a business and we are a commercial enterprise. And maybe people just apply just to think that it might just be a little bit of a jolly. You know, Anna, to be fair, is really, really mucked in and really, really got on with the job.
And have you done any overnights or anything like that yet?
No overnights yet. So I just live down the road, so I come down in the morning and I'll leave in the evening then.
And do you know how many you've delivered so far?
Oh, I'm not sure. I haven't kept a count, but quite a lot. Gwyn's letting me do the majority of them, and then if I need any help, I can just ask him and he'll help me.
So Anna's just found a ewe now that's had her first lamb. She's a set of twins. So she's just now going to get this ewe in a pen with her lamb.
So I'm just putting my hand up now to see if I can feel anything. And it looks like it's quite close. I can feel two legs and a head. So I'll just pull the one leg at the moment because they're quite close to the end. Oh, but coming straight out.
Oh, and there it is.
Excellent. Well done.
Oh, well done.
There you go.
Very good. Anna Brooks and Gwyn Johnson. Well, those lambs might well pass through their local auction mart at some point, hopefully turning a decent profit for Gwyn Johnson, the farmer. Livestock markets in England and Wales have reported record-breaking figures for 2025. The latest figures from the Livestock Auctioneers Association show that turnover was up almost £500 million to just under £3 billion in total, a 20% rise year on year. That coincides with a reduction in the number of both sheep and cattle in the UK. I asked Alistair Brown from the Livestock Auctioneers Association why turnover has risen so much.
2025 was exceptional for us. Prices have drawn farmers back into the markets. Easter and the Festival of Eid lifting the prices tremendously amount in the last month for old season and new lambs. So that's also drawing people back into the markets.
And is this a result of the reduction in the size of the national flock and the national herd of cattle? There are simply fewer animals around.
I think there's a lot more people eating lamb, and it's been exported a great deal more than what we've been doing over the past 10 years or so. I think that's reflecting in the actual demand of it. But generally, yes, if there's less about it, it's a simple supply and demand case that's lifted the prices.
Yeah, we regularly report on this programme about the pressures that farmers are facing through increased costs, things like feed, fertiliser and particularly at the moment fuel. But these figures seem to suggest that there is plenty of confidence in the industry, certainly in the livestock industry.
It seems to be a fantastic amount of promise and towards the future. You know, it seems really, really good. Even though all these prices of fuel and everything else, feed and fertiliser, are going up through the roof, there still seems to be a massive amount of confidence in the sheep job.
This is the second or maybe third, even, you can tell me, year of high demand and high prices. Are they set to stay, or do you think this is a bubble that is going to burst?
Just let me clean my crystal ball. I believe that it's going to stay. You know, we can see ourselves, the population growing in just the UK, never mind around the world. So, you know, there's no reason why there shouldn't be any less demand for what we've got.
Well, it probably depends on price, doesn't it? I mean, these high prices are great news for farmers, but perhaps bad news for shoppers. We are seeing higher prices in the shops for red meat.
I think we've been saying this for 3 or 4 years, that it won't get to such and such a price, but it seems to be year on year increasing the prices. And there's none of it left in the fridges at the abattoirs. There's none left on the shelves. It seems somebody seems to be eating it, however dear it gets. I think it's a stable food that people need in their diets. But I think it may be interesting to see when they put an extra £20 or £30 of fuel in the car to travel the week. It may be interesting to see whether they knock it off the shopping bill.
Alistair Brown from the Livestock Auctioneers Association. Well, talking of fuel, UK fishing crews are asking the government for help in the face of rising costs because of the conflict in the Middle East. The National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations says it's difficult to pass on the hike in diesel prices to customers because fish are sold at auction. It's written to the Minister for Food Security, Angela Eagle, pointing out that some European countries have already announced support packages to help with rising prices. Charlotte Smith spoke to the chief executive of the NFFO, Mike Cohen, and he told her what's happened to the cost of fueling a boat.
On average, across the country, prices were up 75% since the beginning of March. So extremely difficult numbers for any business to cope with.
What sort of impact does that have?
Fishing businesses are particularly vulnerable to input cost shocks. We are price takers as an industry. You know, the catch of the fishing boat is generally sold at auction. We aren't able to increase the price that we get for the catch in response to increased costs to gather that catch. We're kind of squeezed in the middle, and that's really, really damaging. If the price rises to a point where it's no longer economical for a boat to go to sea, that vessel's going to be tied up. The crew won't get paid. Fishermen work for a share of the catch. So if the crew aren't getting paid, they're going to look elsewhere for work, and we lose people to other sectors. And what experience has told us is that once we lose people, we don't get them back again. So that's skilled workers gone from the sector. And that has a huge and long-term impact on the ability of fishing businesses to work and on our ability to produce food in this country.
Are we at that point yet?
We are not at that point. We're very close to that point. We are very, very close to that point. I haven't heard about people having to tie up just yet, but I've had people tell me that they are getting very close to it. If we see prices rise any further, if we see the extremely enhanced prices continue at this level for a long time, then we will reach that point. There's no doubt about it.
You've written to the government. What do you want them to do?
We'd like the government to start talking to us about what support they can provide to industry. Spain has done that for fishermen now. They've created a €25 million crisis fund to help fishing businesses weather the storm. That will directly pay for increased fuel and operating costs to keep those businesses viable until, hopefully, that price normalises again in the not too distant future. So we'd like our government to consider something along the lines of the sort of support that our competitors are getting from their governments.
The government, though, might say, look, there are lots of industries that are suffering because of the price of fuel going up. Farmers, for instance, are saying that with the price of fuel and fertiliser, they too are in trouble. And the government will point out they do not have a magic money tree.
Absolutely, and I'd agree with that. And I would see farmers as being in exactly the same position as us, and there'll be lots of industries that need support. And we have to be reasonable in expecting government to think about where it needs to put that support. But food is more important than an awful lot of things. And our ability to produce food, not just to import it, is something that I think we should really be focusing on more and more as the fragility of global trade is highlighted by this situation.
Mike Cohen of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations. There's concern that animal welfare may be at risk on some Scottish islands because of widespread disruption to ferry services. 8 ferries serving islands on the west coast of Scotland were out of service earlier this week, either due to faults or scheduled maintenance, with CalMac, Caledonian McBrain, the government-owned company that runs them, describing the situation as critical, with almost every island affected. NFU Scotland says there's a risk that vital supplies like feed and fertiliser won't get to crofts and farms when they're most needed. Well, we thought we would take a look at how one island is being affected by this ferry crisis, the Isle of Barra. It's at the southernmost end of the Outer Hebrides, has stunning beaches, crofting and fishing businesses, a population of around 1,200 people, and it relies on its ferries. Donald Joseph is a crofter and haulier. He's based on Barra, and his lorry delivers fodder for livestock there. I asked him how the ferry services there are affected.
Oh, it's near, well, it's near impossible at the moment. We don't have a ferry. Now we've been sent up to Ujomskaya, which is a 3.5-hour, 4-hour journey to another island north of us. And then you've got to go from there to the central belt of wherever you're going, which is another, in a truck, it's 7 hours. And you need 2 drivers, because your working time directive does not allow you to do that. It's taking us twice as long to get there and double the cost. And especially just now with fuel prices going through the roof, so it's having huge, huge implications on businesses on the island and on crofters that are running out of feedstuffs. And we've had a bad winter with weather anyway. And on top of what's happening, it'll put crofters out of business.
I know that you bring hay onto the island. Tell me, how are current feedstocks? Is there enough hay to keep crofters going?
Not really. No, people are running out of hay. And it's the time of year when animals are calving and you're going through a lot more forest to keep them going. And the weather has been atrocious. And that doesn't help matters. We just can't get onto the island. And at costing an extra 80% to what it should be. And people just can't afford to pay that.
And have you been in touch with CalMac? What do they say?
You get the usual from CalMac, we're doing your best. But their best is not good enough. No, we need a ferry of our own.
You know, NFU Scotland has raised concerns that this could turn into an animal welfare situation. I know that you're a crofter as well. Do you think that is possible? Is that going to happen?
Oh, that could very well happen if it's not rectified sooner rather than later. We're heavily dependent on getting fodder onto the island. And a lot of that fodder comes from Stirling. But it's the cost implication now on trying to get it onto the island. Shops, they're struggling to get vital supplies onto the island. Medical supplies are struggling to get onto the island. It's affecting everyone living on the island one way or another.
That's Donald Joseph. Well, we approached CalMac Ferries and they told us that they're working towards restoring what they call a level of normality to services to the Outer Hebrides by the middle of this coming week. And Scotland's Transport Secretary Fiona Hislop told us that their priority is to ensure minimum disruption and to restore services as quickly as possible. And she also advises people travelling in the coming days to check with their operators to understand any impacts. And that's all from us for today. I'm Kaz Graham. The producer is Beatrice Fenton. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
We'll join the Today programme in a couple of minutes. But first, looking ahead to later on this morning, Tom Stoppard was, of course, best known for his work writing for stage and screen. But the dramas that he created for radio were also an extremely important part of his career. All this weekend, Radio 4 is celebrating the work of Tom Stoppard. And as part of that, John York will be looking at how Tom contributed to a golden age in BBC radio drama. Opening Lines, part of our Celebrating Stoppard collection of programmes, is at 10. Now, though, here's Louise Lear with a look at today's weather.
Good morning. Plenty to talk about with the weather story as we go through this Easter weekend. Not a bad start to today. I'll come on to Storm Dave in just a moment. But for many, there's a lot of dry weather out there. And in eastern parts of Scotland and England, there'll be some sunshine. You could cling on to some sunshine across East Anglia, the Midlands and South East England for much of the day. But it will quickly cloud over from the west, and the cloud thick enough for some light drizzly rain across South West England and South Wales and across North Wales as we speak. Now, this is actually Storm Dave. It's going to rapidly intensify as we move into the afternoon and become quite a significant storm impacting Northern Ireland and parts of Scotland through the evening and overnight. So the winds a main feature, gusts in excess of 70 miles an hour. On exposed coast, we could see them as strong as 80 to 90 miles an hour. And that's also going to bring some heavy rain, 50 millimetres of rain and times some significant snow to the far northwest to higher ground. So blizzard-like conditions through the night. So a very wet, windy, stormy spell overnight tonight, but it rattles through at quite a pace. And so when you wake up tomorrow morning, actually, it's going to be a dry, largely blustery, but a day of sunny spells and scattered showers. So Easter Day itself, not faring too badly. It won't be quite as warm as today. I should have said top temperatures today 14 to 17 Celsius with the sunshine, 7 to 10 in Scotland. But tomorrow it's going to be a case of sunny spells, blustery showers. Some of the showers will still be at wintry to higher ground in Scotland, and a cooler feeling day, highs likely a 7 to 12 degrees. High pressure is set to build as we move into Easter Monday. That means a good deal of dry weather right across the country, and temperatures will start to recover, mid-teens perhaps, on Easter Monday. And then, as we go into Tuesday and Wednesday, it could get warmer still. We're expecting highs of 21 degrees in the southeast during Tuesday afternoon. That's it. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Louise. We'll join the Today programme here on Radio 4 after this.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
If you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go?
Glasgow.
So where are you from then?
The Glens of Antrim.
Lovely part of the world.
Can we just move to Barry? It's well lush.
Hello, love. Welcome to Barry. You'll always be
my home. Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 4th of April. This is Today with Sean Farrington and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning: the United States and Iran are trying to find the missing crew member of an American fighter jet which Tehran says it shot down. Five officers have been removed from frontline duties after a bag of police-issued guns was found on a street in London.
Also in today's programme, are people buying enough electric cars to justify the money that's being spent on the charging points? Teachers are warning that online misogyny is spilling into classrooms, so with abuse against female staff rising, we'll hear about some of the efforts to tackle it. And?
You know, it's great to think that, with the exception of our four friends, all of us are represented in this image.
The Artemis astronauts are now halfway to the moon, and they've been sending back stunning pictures of our planet.
And I'm Jane Dougal with your Saturday Sport. I've been speaking to boxer Lauren Price, who'll defend her belt tonight at the Cardiff Arena in a world title fight against Puerto Rican Stephanie Pinheiro, and it's live on the BBC.
I think it's fantastic, and, you know, it's going to turn me into a star, hopefully, with more eyes on me, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
Iran and the US are racing to find the missing crew member of a downed American fighter jet. Tehran says it shot down the F-15 over the southwest of the country yesterday, and that soldiers are now combing the area. US officials have told the BBC's partner network CBS News that the other person in the aircraft has been rescued. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalawasho reports from Washington.
This is the first known case of a U.S. military aircraft being shut down over Iran during this war. President Trump had claimed that Iran couldn't do a thing about American aircraft operating over its territory and that its air defenses had been significantly weakened. Iran's Revolutionary Guard is now said to have sealed off a huge area and begun a search for the missing U.S. service personnel, turning this into a high-stakes race on the ground between the two adversaries. In a further blow to Washington, Iran claims to have shot down a second U.S. warplane. U.S. media say the A-10 Warthog was targeted near the Strait of Hormuz during a search and rescue mission for the first downed aircraft. The pilot ejected and was rescued. President Trump insisted last night that the loss of the F-15 would not affect negotiations with Iran, saying it's war.
Iranian missiles have hit residential areas in parts of central Israel. The emergency services say one person has been injured. Iran is also continuing its attacks on Gulf states. Bahrain has urged residents to seek shelter. Officials in the United Arab Emirates say shrapnel from a successful aerial interception has fallen on a building in the Dubai Marina area. The Metropolitan Police has removed five officers from frontline duties after a bag of guns issued by the force was reportedly left outside the home of the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan. Scotland Yard said it believed the weapons were misplaced. Greg McKenzie reports.
A bag containing Metropolitan Police firearms, reportedly including a submachine gun, a taser and ammunition, has been recovered after being found on a South London street. A local man, Jordan Griffiths, said his partner discovered the bag by the curb on Tuesday evening. He told the Sun newspaper he was shocked by its contents and immediately contacted police. Officers arrived within minutes to retrieve the weapons. The Metropolitan Police say the bag is believed to have been misplaced by on-duty officers. Five officers have been removed from frontline duties, and the force says an urgent internal review is now underway. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London described it as a very serious incident and said the Met should take all steps to ensure it never happened again.
Three people have been charged after an arson attack destroyed four ambulances in northwest London. The vehicles belonging to a Jewish charity were set on fire in Golders Green. More details from our special correspondent Lucy Manning.
The Crown Prosecution Service said it had charged 20-year-old Hamza Iqbal, 19-year-old Rayhan Khan and a 17-year-old who can't be named for legal reasons with arson, with intent to damage property and being reckless as to whether life would be endangered. The ambulances were set on fire last week in the grounds of a synagogue car park. Oxygen canisters inside the vehicles caused explosions which damaged nearby buildings. The ambulances were run by the voluntary Jewish group Hatzolah, which treats patients of any religion. The three suspects were arrested on Wednesday and their addresses were searched. The Metropolitan Police says Hamza Iqbal and Rayhan Khan are British nationals from Leighton, and the unnamed 17-year-old is a dual British Pakistani national from Walthamstow. Scotland Yard said although the investigation was being led by counter-terror policing, it had not yet been declared a terrorism incident.
The NASUWT teaching union has warned there's a masculinity crisis brewing in schools. A survey of its members suggests the percentage of female teachers facing misogyny from pupils has risen for the fourth year in a row. Here's our education reporter, Kate McGough.
What's become known as the Manosphere is a loose network of online communities and influencers targeting male audiences that claims to address men's struggles around things such as dating or fitness. But often it also promotes misogynistic attitudes. The teaching union, the NASUWT, questioned 5,000 of its members ahead of its conference this weekend. Nearly a quarter of the female teachers who responded said they'd experienced misogyny from a pupil in the last year, the highest proportion in 4 years. The government is currently consulting on whether or not to ban social media for under-16s, and it's recently issued new guidance for teachers on how to help pupils recognise and challenge misogyny. But the union wants to see more training on how to tackle this in the classroom.
Astronauts on NASA's Artemis 2 mission are now more than halfway to the moon, more than 130,000 miles from Earth, and are on course to fly past it on Monday evening. They've sent back some of the most detailed pictures yet of their journey, including a stunning image of our planet that's been named Hello World. Our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh is following the mission from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
In the latest image sent back by the Artemis 2 crew, the entire Earth hangs luminous in the blackness of space. Deep blue oceans, swirling white clouds and a bright atmosphere give it the appearance of a shimmering jewelled marble. It's an echo of the first colour photograph of Earth taken by the astronauts of Apollo 8 in 1968, an image that provided a moment of hope and optimism to a divided and war-torn world. And perhaps the new picture might have the same effect. There'll be more spectacular images as the Orion spacecraft hurtles towards its destination, with our world getting progressively smaller and the moon becoming larger and revealing new details of the lunar landscape.
Donald Trump has asked Congress for around $150 million to reopen Alcatraz Prison in California. The US president first floated the idea last year on social media and is now requesting the funding as part of the latest White House budget proposal. Alcatraz is one of San Francisco's biggest tourist attractions after closing as a prison in 1963. US media say government officials believe a full reopening as a maximum security facility would cost around $2 billion. The King has personally approved the design for a garden at this year's Chelsea Flower Show. It's been created by Francis Tophill in conjunction with the Royal Horticultural Society and the charity The King's Foundation. Sean Dilley reports.
King Charles has had an input into the design of what's being called the Curiosity Garden. So too have the King's Foundation ambassadors, the former England football captain Sir David Beckham and TV gardener Alan Titchmarsh. The garden will feature delphiniums, one of the King's favourite flowers, and roses named after the three men. Seven raised beds will pay homage to Sir David's football shirt number, and a beehive will nod to his and the King's shared passion for producing honey. Trainees and apprentices from the King's Highgrove residence in Gloucestershire and RHS Wisley have been involved in constructing the garden. Although it's not confirmed, there could even be a gnome or two in the King's garden. The RHS has lifted its ban on the ornamental figures at Chelsea for only the second time in history, and gnomes can be found in the stumpery of the King's country home, Highgrove.
That report was from Sean Dilley.
Thank you, Alan. It's 9 minutes past seven now. Let's take a first look at the morning papers. The Daily Mail is calling the race between the US and Iran to find the missing crew member of a downed American jet a head-to-head competition between the warring sides. We're going to talk about this in just a moment. The paper says the images of debris from the plane are a major propaganda boost for the Iranian regime. According to The Guardian, aviation experts believe the wreckage is from an aircraft that's part of a US squadron that's based in the UK. The Daily Telegraph says if the aircraft did fly from the UK, it may raise difficult questions for Keir Starmer, who said that the US can use bases on British soil only for defensive operations. The Times this morning says as long as the crew member is unaccounted for, in its words, Trump's war in Iran will be overshadowed by concerns about their fate.
Not the economic impact picked up by a couple of the papers. The FT Weekend carries a warning that diesel prices in the UK could hit £2 a litre within days. It says the wholesale cost of the fuel has surged to a four-year high. The Daily Mirror says fat cats running four of Britain's biggest energy industry giants have seen the value of their shareholdings jump since before the war. The paper says Centrica and Shell declined to comment, while Harbour and BP did not respond.
The Eye Weekend says more than 500 members of the British Armed Forces stationed at sensitive military sites have revealed their locations on the fitness tracking app Strava. The paper says runners at one UK-US base even jokingly called the route security breach. Strava was approached for comment. The Ministry of Defence said it took the security of personnel very seriously and kept its guidance under constant review.
The Sun leads on armed police leaving a bag of guns on the street outside the house of the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan. The paper goes with the headline, "Can't make it up," and calls it a major security blunder. Scotland Yard has begun an internal review.
And the Daily Express this morning says it's marmalade madness that the British breakfast favourite could be rebranded as part of a deal with the EU. It says Labour's agreement on food has been called completely bonkers. The government insists that British marmalade is not changing and that its agreement with Brussels supports businesses by removing red tape.
It's 11 minutes past seven now. Let's have a look at the race that continues to find the missing American crew member of the downed US fighter jet in Iran. The message to Iranian citizens from state-backed Iranian channels is capture them alive and you'll get a reward. America's approach? Well, there's been this video that showed what appeared to be an American plane accompanied by two helicopters flying over southern Iran as a search and rescue mission was carried out. That rescued one crew member, according to reports in the US, while they continue to search for this second crew member. Our correspondent, Joe Inwood, has been looking at how the downed aircraft is being viewed inside Iran.
On a rocky, barren hillside, somewhere in the southern Iranian province of Kugilyar, dozens of men are running. The direction is not clear, but their target is quite obvious. Iranian State TV has just put out this message. If you capture an enemy pilot and hand them over alive to the military or law enforcement, you will be given a suitable reward, the newsreader says. And that call seems to have been answered. In more footage shared online, a group of men carrying Iranian flags and armed with a combination of hunting rifles, AK-47s and pistols walk past the camera.
Inshallah.
Don't worry, he'll be found, one of them says. as they continue their search for the downed US air crew. For the government in Tehran, shooting down a US jet is a propaganda coup. This is a military spokesman hailing the success of their newly developed air defences. But for others, especially those who contacted the BBC's Persian service, there was concern about what this could mean for the direction of the war.
I reckon this is meant to set up a ground invasion. I mean, more than 30 days into the war, your aircraft ends up destroyed. Your pilot's stuck in another country. You can't take out the missile site, but you hit a bridge instead.
The bridge he refers to is the B-1, a major connection between the capital, Tehran, and the nearby city of Karaj, just to the west. And this was the moment it was utterly destroyed. Multiple US airstrikes collapsing sections of a structure that had only just been completed. By the time the TV crews arrived, the dust had settled, and all that was left was exposed metalwork and crumbling concrete. Overlooking it all was Yazdi, a heavy-set man, maybe in his late 40s. He's wearing a US-made sports top, but is grieving for the damage that they have done to the bridge that he helped build. I feel really sad because my colleagues and I worked day and night for 2 years to build this bridge, he says. We shed tears and sweat. We gave it everything. But now all our efforts are just wasted like that. I also feel immense grief and deep sorrow. The destruction of the B-1 bridge came just hours after Donald Trump had said this.
We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
In the town of Fardis, just to the south of the bridge, Benaz Karimi stands looking at her ruined neighborhood. She is wearing a black and white floral headscarf and is seething at Donald Trump's remarks.
When we were in the Stone Age, we were still more advanced than the Americans. When you love your homeland, you'd even love the rubble left from your homes.
Even for opponents of the regime, the threats to destroy Iranian infrastructure have caused real anger and fear.
I feel hopeless. Trump posts shamelessly about attacking our bridge. I don't know how much further this is going to go. Why is no one standing up to him? He's really taking us back to the Stone Age.
We will end up with a ruined country. I'm more disappointed and saddened that I'm in the middle of a situation where I see Iran being destroyed and I can't do anything. My country is being destroyed more and more every day.
This war began with the promise of a swift victory and freedom for the people of Iran. More than a month in, and as more bombs fall over the capital, neither feels like a promise that is likely to be fulfilled.
Joe Inwood reporting on latest developments in Iran there. I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, who is the defence editor at The Economist. Good morning to you. What have you learnt from the last 24 hours and what has happened with the jet in Iran here that has been downed?
Well, we know we have pictures of debris of this F-15E Strike Eagle, and that's a fighter jet. It's got a crew of two. I think it's got a pilot and a weapons systems officer. And so we're pretty confident it has gone down. The Americans have all but said that. We know that one of those crew members, we're not sure if it's the pilot or the other officer, has been rescued, but there's one still unaccounted for. And we've seen search and rescue assets, including modified cargo planes and Black Hawks in Khuzestan in southwestern Iran, flying very low in broad daylight yesterday, clearly looking for this downed crew member across Iran. And so far this morning, it appears they've not had any luck, which is very, very bad news for the Americans.
Are you able to give us any more detail on how they would have rescued one of those crew members?
Well, what typically happens is you've got these special operations helicopters that are aided by these broader modified cargo planes. Cargo planes serve as a kind of command post as a communications relay, also refueling. In some of the videos, you can see them refueling the helicopters. And then essentially they're able to land or pick up downed pilots if they find them on the ground by scanning large amounts of territory. It's a very, very dangerous mission. And in fact, what we saw yesterday was also that an A-10 ground attack plane, also apparently involved in the search, was hit by Iranian fire near the Strait of Hormuz, and the pilot ejected. He or she was rescued. And we also saw another one of these modified Black Hawks struck that apparently made it back into Iraq. So I think what that shows is that the rescue mission itself is liable to become a source of considerable problems to the Americans.
As we sort of well know from recent weeks, not all Iranians are supportive of the leadership in Iran at the moment. Is it necessarily the case that if the crew member who's not been found is found by Iranians, that it will go through that process of them receiving a bounty, them wanting a bounty, or could they actually be of some help?
It's very hard to say. I mean, as you point out, Iran's population is diverse. This is in Khuzestan in the southwest. There are also ethnic minority populations that have long been estranged from the central government and long opposed to it. And that can also play to the pilots' favor if they find themselves in the right communities. But of course, this does come after 5 weeks of very harsh language, not just Donald Trump's comments that you played, but also Pete Hegseth saying that he would want Americans to show no mercy and no quarter towards the Iranian forces. I think that will go down quite badly. But what I will say is the longer this goes on, the less chance of a rescue, because if you look at the first Gulf War, I think some pilots evaded capture for hours, but really the longest I think we saw was 3 nights, and then those crew were eventually captured near the Syrian border. In this case, given the geography of Khuzestan, it's very hard to see where they would go. There's rivers to cross if you're trying to get to Iraq or you're trying to get to the Gulf states. I'm concerned that the longer this goes on, the lower the chance of rescue, although I think the advantage the Americans have, of course, is still quite a lot of control over the air relative to what they did in Iraq.
Shashank Joshi, thank you for your time this morning, defence editor at The Economist.
Let's turn for a moment at 7:20 to the economic impact of the war, well reported on this programme and on others as well, which has led unions now to call for an emergency package of support to protect manufacturers. Soaring energy prices are a particular problem, hitting industries like chemicals, ceramics and glass, the ones who really rely on that kind of thing. Paul Novak is with us, General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress. Good morning.
Morning, Anna.
The government has said that they are on this. They said they've got plans to cut electricity bills by up to 25% for over 7,000 businesses, but no details yet about actually the eligibility for that, who that will help.
No details yet. And I think what we're saying is there needs to be further targeted support, particularly for those employers and businesses that are reliant on gas, because gas prices have doubled now since the end of February, and that has having a real impact in sectors like ceramics, like in brick making, like other key manufacturing sectors. And these aren't theoretical risks. These are real, clear and present dangers to those employers and crucially to good quality jobs.
How are those manufacturers dealing with it? Are they at the stage yet where they're having to bring their workers in for less time? Are they having to cut back on production? What is happening with them?
Well, there's a real range of experience. I spoke to one of our unions at the end of, at the beginning of this week, and we've got companies that are going into administration, other companies that are talking to unions actively about things like layoffs, others that are just trying to get over these short-term pressures and hoping that they can get through things. But it's clear we think that there needs to be support from government. So as I say, I think we're calling for a cap on gas prices in the short term for those industrial users, for the government to bring forward its energy support scheme. It's slated to start next year, which would make a difference to those who are using electricity. But also in the medium term, to bring together unions, employers, to identify where the pinch points there are pressures certainly in terms of energy costs. We know there are going to be other supply chain issues as this crisis goes on. So really a need for government to engage with employers and unions and to make sure that, as I say, we've got a laser-like focus on protecting good quality jobs.
In the conversations that you're having with the government, does it sound like you're going to get those things you're asking for?
Well, listen, I think that there's definitely been progress. I was on a call last week with the Secretary of State for Business, Peter Kyle, alongside a whole range of different British businesses, and he set out the government's approach. Now, I think, obviously, rightly, the government is taking time to make sure that they've diagnosed the problem correctly, but that they're also identifying the right solutions, targeted support that will have the most impact. But really, it is now time for us to see action. I'm hopeful that the government will move. The Chancellor has talked about targeted support for households and targeted support for businesses. Let's make sure we work together to get that support in place as quickly as possible.
So for you, it's about speed of response. I suppose also for your members, but for all of us, really, it's the difficulty of not knowing how long this will last for as well. At the moment, we just see prices going up, but no sign of when they might come back down again.
No, absolutely. I mean, nobody quite knows how this is all going to play out, but that's why I think it is really important that you put in place the mechanisms to make sure you've got intelligence coming straight from the shop floor. So, as I say, that national task force bringing together unions and employers. In the longer term, we've got to try and make sure that we're not in this vulnerable position going forward. So that means things like increasing our gas storage capacity in the UK, gutted by the previous government. We've got about a tenth of the gas storage capacity of the Netherlands, a sixth of the storage capacity in Germany and France. If we want to insulate ourselves against these shocks, we need to increase that gas storage. We need to step up our efforts to bring in energy efficiency and electrification measures in workplaces. And ultimately, we need to couple industrial energy prices from gas prices, international gas prices.
Paul Novak, General Secretary of the TUC, thank you.
It's just coming up to 25 minutes past seven. I mean, we know as the petrol and diesel price has risen in recent weeks, more people have been paying attention, giving a bit more thought perhaps to owning an electric vehicle. But the availability and spread of public chargers has long been high up the list of concerns of drivers. Now some of the companies behind those chargers are considering stopping investments in the network if the government weakens plans to end sales of new petrol and diesel cars as it has at the moment. Vicky Reid is Chief Executive of Charge UK, the trade body for that industry. Vicky, what's the problem with the approach at the moment?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the programme. Yeah, you're right. So the transition to EVs is a key government policy and charging is a really essential part of that. The good news is the transition is really gathering pace. There are now 2 million EVs on our roads. One in four new cars sold is electric. And as you just said, there's a surge in interest right now because of the price of petrol. Now, all those cars that have been sold in recent years have been possible because of a thriving charging sector that's emerged in this country. Thousands of jobs, £6 billion of investment committed. And that sector and that investment has delivered 118,000 public chargers to date. That's around twice the number of petrol pumps and well over a million chargers at homes and in workplaces. But what we've been talking to government about recently is how to keep up that progress, how to keep that investment coming, because that charging rollout has been made possible thanks to something called the ZEV mandate, which you mentioned just now, which sets out EV sales quotas for car companies. And it's giving our sector the confidence to invest. Yet only a year after the mandate was last reviewed and made slightly weaker, the government's preparing to review it again under pressure from car makers. Now, if this mandate comes through and it's weakened, that will be the polar opposite of what you need to secure the charging rollout. And that's what we've told the government.
But the car industry themselves, many of those manufacturing those cars, have said that the industry would be in deep jeopardy, to quote them, if without changes to these policies. You know, they've had already been talking about high production costs and low demand for these electric vehicles anyway, and therefore they need to see that there was some weakening of this policy.
Well, there's no doubt the mandate is ambitious. It rises each year through to 80% in 2030. But government figures that the show that the 24 and 25 targets were not just met but exceeded. Now, as you say, certain parts of the automotive sector are saying that those targets are too challenging. Obviously, it's up to them to explain why. But from our point of view, that doesn't really make sense, because if the mandate is weakened and charging rollout stalls or becomes more expensive, it will be harder, not easier, to sell EVs.
Government also saying never been cheaper or easier to own an electric vehicle. In the last few weeks, we've heard from many across the electric vehicle industry about the increased interest from people because of higher petrol and diesel prices. Wouldn't it be a very foolish time to be stopping investment if there has been a sudden bit of momentum naturally from people around the country towards charging their car?
No, I mean, let's be no doubt here. Our sector is desperate to make investment and to deploy infrastructure. That's what we exist to do. But charge point deployment is hugely expensive and chargers need to be installed well ahead of demand. So our sector, which is still pre-profit, has to place a massive bet years before returns are likely. Now, the mandate that we've been talking about de-risks that bet. It gives investors the green light. If it's weakened again, we predict hundreds of millions of pounds of investment will walk, in particular in more rural areas and locations outside the southeast where the economics are just tougher. This is not a theoretical risk. It's this week, one of our members told me that they had to cancel a £12 million investment into Hull, Bradford, Liverpool and Scotland, all because of policy uncertainty. So we need that uncertainty removed.
Vicky Reid, Chief Executive of Charge UK. Thank you for your time.
It's 28 minutes past seven. Time for the sport. And with us here in Salford this morning is Jane Doodle. Hello.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Sean. We've got a big night of boxing ahead of us. And I've been speaking to Lauren Price, who's putting her belts on the line. The Welsh Olympic gold medalist is facing Puerto Rican Stephanie Pinheiro. And she's expecting a warm welcome at the Cardiff Arena.
It gives me goosebumps at the time. You know, I'm so proud to be Welsh. And I can't really explain it. I think as an amateur, I box all around the world. I last boxed in Cardiff, obviously, 2 years ago. And that was my homecoming. And it was one of the best nights of my life. And I'm so proud to be Welsh. Like, we are a small nation, but we proper get behind our own. And I'm so grateful for the fans. If it wasn't for them coming out on Saturday to watch me, I wouldn't be able to have my night, along with the undercard as well, with the lads. So, yeah, I'm just thankful for everyone who's come in. And what better platform than to, you know, be on BBC for everyone to tune in and watch?
Well, exactly, free to air as well. And that does do a lot for the sport, for women's boxing, doesn't it?
Yeah, massively. And I think, like, a lot of people, especially with my nan from in Ashramanach up in the valleys, it's kind of an older generation, and for them, everyone's got BBC, they can tune in and watch me, and I think it's fantastic. And, you know, it's going to turn me into a star, hopefully, with more eyes on me, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Talk me through a typical day. Talk me through a typical meals for every day.
So, 7 o'clock, my alarm goes off. Obviously, boxing being a weight-making sport, I go down to the kitchen, stand on the scales, check my weight every morning, send it in to my nutritionist, and then obviously head down to the track for half seven. You know, I eat like good food, so it's like your pasta, your chicken, your rice. I always eat porridge, so the number of oats I have, I normally have 100 grams of oats. Whack my protein powder in there. My nutritionist, he basically cost me a fortune, because fruit, I have 80 grams of strawberries, 80 grams of blueberries, and that's like a full packet near enough. Every meal I have porridge. So, yeah, but it works.
Lauren, no disrespect at all to Pinheiro, but many of your fans are looking ahead to a match-up against the three-weight world champion American Clarissa Shields. Now, that would be mouth-watering. How likely is that fight to happen?
Well, I can't really say too much, but Saturday night you might all have a surprise.
Oh, an exclusive perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah, obviously there's massive fights out there for me, Shields being one of them. But yeah, like, obviously my main focus is obviously getting the job done Saturday and then obviously moving on from there.
Just finally, Lauren, you're an incredible boxer. Of course you're an incredible boxer, but even incredible boxers get hit in the face sometimes. So having the odd black eye is perhaps an occupational hazard, and that might be a problem come May. Can you tell us why?
Well, obviously I'm getting married to my wonderful partner, Carly Jones. Yeah, I mean, it's quite close, but the way my schedule works, I was like, this is how it's got to work, and this is, you know, that's part of the game, and she totally understands that. I have got a good makeup artist, but like I said, hopefully, you know, I come out, touch wood, not too marked up. I probably have a few grazes, but they should be gone by the time, you know, the wedding comes round. But yeah, I'm fully confident, you know, that the makeup artist will sort it out anyway.
Brilliant. Well, we wish you the very best of luck. And I know your fans will all be supporting you. Huge, huge support in Wales and in Cardiff. Thank you very much for your time, Lauren.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, let's hope she doesn't need that makeup artist. Price is on the undercard of the heavyweight fight between Derek Chisora and Deontay Wilder. Coverage on a big night of boxing in Cardiff, all on BBC Two and BBC iPlayer from 6.
Thank you, Jane. Simon Jack is presenting Broadcasting House tomorrow morning. Here he is now to tell us what we can expect. Sunday will see the first Easter address from Pope Leo XIV. We'll have a report from Rome and get some thoughts on the new Archbishop of Canterbury's Easter debut. As our intrepid astronauts will be about to turn to the dark side of the moon, that is, we'll look at why it has intrigued and inspired Pink Floyd, H.G. Wells and many more besides.
We'll bring you the latest developments from the conflict in the Gulf, of course, and ask why it is that while governments in Asia and Europe are mandating or suggesting changes that might make sense to use less energy, there seems a reluctance here in the UK to ask us to do the same. That's Broadcasting House, BH, tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Take a quick look at the weather this morning. Don't be fooled if it's nice where you are just now, because it will gradually become windy today and overnight, as well as Storm Dave approaches from the west.
The time now is the 7:33 you're listening to today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Sean Farrington, and a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
US and Iranian forces are in a race to find the missing crew member of a downed American fighter jet. Tehran claims to have shot down the F-15 over the southwest of the country yesterday. State media in Iran says a valuable reward is on offer if the crew member is captured alive. US officials have told the BBC's partner network CBS News that the other person in the aircraft has been rescued. Parts of central Israel have been hit by Iranian missiles, injuring one person. Iran has continued its attacks on Gulf neighbours. Residents in Bahrain were told to seek shelter while shrapnel from an aerial interception fell on a building in Dubai. The Metropolitan Police says it's investigating how a bag of guns issued by the force was left on a street in London, reportedly near the home of the city's mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan. A member of the public called the police after discovering the firearms, which the Sun newspaper says included a Glock pistol, submachine gun and ammunition. Five officers have been removed from frontline duties. Three people have been charged after an arson attack destroyed four ambulances in northwest London. The vehicles belonging to a Jewish charity were set on fire in Golders Green last week. Two British men aged 19 and 20 from Leighton and a 17-year-old boy from Walthamstow, who's a dual British-Pakistani national, will appear before magistrates this morning. A teaching union has warned of a masculinity crisis brewing in schools. A survey of 5,000 members of the NASUWT suggests almost a quarter of female teachers face misogyny from pupils in the past year. One respondent said a student had made naked images of her using AI, while others said they were regularly called misogynistic names. The government says it's giving teachers resources to spot and tackle misogynistic beliefs. And the four astronauts on board NASA's Orion spacecraft have reached the halfway point to the moon, more than 130,000 miles from Earth. The Artemis 2 mission will see them loop around the moon before heading home.
Thank you, Alan. We're going to be speaking to Helen Sharman, of course, first British astronaut to ever go to space, after 8 o'clock. Let's turn our attention now, though, to concerns around the Strait of Hormuz, the latest concerns. The effective blocking that we've seen has raised concerns of crises around the world due to shortages of crucial goods, food, medicines, fertilisers. Here's the head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, talking to us on the programme this week.
What we're warning of today is that there's really 8 to 10 weeks until mid-June for a food security time bomb to be diffused. Remember, we're in a situation where already 45 million people are at severe levels of food insecurity. And the grave danger is that they get pushed over the precipice.
Now, the International Crisis Group have particular concern for some countries in Africa and are leading calls for certain supplies to be allowed through the strait in a similar way to how goods have been moving out of Ukrainian ports right in the middle of a war there. One of the negotiators of what was called the Black Sea Grain Initiative was Martin Griffiths, the former Undersecretary General of Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations, joins us now. Martin, good morning. If we reflect on your negotiations there, how did you get Russia on board with an initiative like that?
I think that's a very, very important question, because it reflects the precedent that we hope to see in the Straits of Hormuz. We got them on board, also Ukraine on board, because, as they frequently told me, they could do this because it was for humanitarian benefit for the world. Global food security was hugely improved by the effort and by the eventual agreement. So they said we couldn't do this together unless it was for a humanitarian purpose. And the same accounts also, obviously, as you've just been saying, for the potential agreement in Straits of Hormuz. It wasn't easy to get the agreement, but it was a classic mediation. We had Turkey, we had the United Nations where I was working, and bringing together you know, the better angels, if you like, it may sound surreal, of the parties.
What would Russia have wanted in return in that situation?
What Russia did get in return in that situation was a memorandum of understanding negotiated by Rebecca Greenspan, the head of UNCTAD, UN Trade and Development Organization, for their key commodities in oil and other such commodities generally unsanctioned to go safely also through the Black Sea for global export. So there was a quid pro quo. And of course, that is, you know, no agreement that's mediated, you know this, Sean, as well as I do, works if it's not win-win. It has to be win-win.
And so when you look at the Strait of Hormuz, sorry to interrupt you there, but when you look at the Strait of Hormuz situation, then how would you see what could be offered to Iran in return?
I think the pitch I would be making to Iran, if I was talking to them very confidentially at the moment, would be this is good for you in the long term. The fact that you are, in fact, there is passage of ships, as you know, Sean, through the Straits at the moment, but for favored nations and for quite a lot of money, apparently. That doesn't meet the needs of the farmers in Africa or the traders across the world or the consumers at the pump also across the world. And for Iran to actually impede global welfare, which is what they would be doing if they continued this way, doesn't do them any good. And I'll make one sort of, I think, key point. What the Black Sea grain deal was about was not just about global food welfare. It was also, and global food security, but it was also about building confidence eventually between those parties. It didn't work in that respect, but it could in this.
Is that something Donald Trump... Oh, sorry, go on, continue.
No. The region will need this at the end of this war, whenever that comes. They will need to live with Iran, and Iran will need to live with the neighbors. This could be a building block for that. And if there isn't such a diplomatic agreement, there will be increased division in that region, and that's very dangerous.
Is this a scenario you can imagine Donald Trump being happy to sign up to if there were ships being allowed through the Strait of Hormuz that weren't necessarily delivering all the oil around the world that he perhaps would like to see, and it was more for humanitarian priorities?
Yes, I think he would. And there are some indications, I think, privately that he is supportive of this. It's very important, as you know, in any of such negotiations in a war, that neither party is seen to gain some precedence or favor over the other. Back to the win-win point made earlier. And so, yes, I think Donald Trump would be in favor. I think it needs to be more than humanitarian. I think it needs to prioritize humanitarian, but needs to include, of course, energy, LNG and oil and so forth. It also needs to include exports from Iran and the Gulf.
How serious a scenario is this, Martin, just to wrap this? Before you think that there is going to be serious food security consequences impacting people?
Well, I think we're already there. David Miliband on your show, you know, said something of that sort. 45 million people, according to the World Food Programme, in Africa alone, at risk of acute hunger. But the planting season is starting in April. That's where we are now, and going through to June. So it's not as if you stop worrying after the planting season when there hasn't been enough planted. But you can do something preventive, if you like, in this immediate term.
Martin, thank you for your time. Martin Griffiths there, the former Undersecretary General of Humanitarian Affairs for the United Nations.
It's 19 minutes to 8 now. The line between where AI should and shouldn't be used is a constant topic of debate, isn't it? Sometimes the division is quite obvious, but in the last week or so, the lines have been blurring a little around creativity and written work by journalists and authors. The New York Times publicly cut ties with a freelancer, Alex Preston, who used AI to help write a book review. And the reform candidate Matt Goodwin got into an online row about whether he had used it to write a book. He was accused of that book containing erroneous quotations that AI might have put in there. Well, Sam Leith joins us, literary editor of The Spectator, and Alexandra Pringle, who's a former editor-in-chief of Bloomsbury Publishing. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sam, you've had a conversation with Alex Preston about this. He told The Guardian that he was hugely embarrassed and truly sorry. But what did he say to you about his motivation, his reasoning?
Well, it was very strange to me. It was strange that he was doing it in the first place, given he's got a substantial reputation as a critic. And the AI plagiarized directly work from The Guardian review. And he said that he'd come in under word count, had been desperately busy and drowning in other work or something, and had used this Ask ChatGPT or some similar LLM tool to pad his piece out to get it up to the word count, and had not noticed that in so doing it had incorporated lines of somebody else's prose entirely. I am as baffled now as I was then. But his line of defense, such as it was, though he very much didn't attempt to say that this got him off the hook, was, well, I didn't get it to write the whole thing. I was simply asking it to kind of polish it up, and I didn't know that it was going to pinch someone else's words entirely and didn't check.
Yeah, it seems, Sam, when you think of what you could use AI for, if it was some sort of business report or something which was anonymous and it's sort of quite a workmanlike piece, but something like literary criticism, which is so much based in the thoughts and opinions of the writer, it would seem on the face of it a strange place to bring in something like AI.
I think it's absolutely bizarre, and I think it's a complete no-no. I mean, if newspapers wanted, their books to be reviewed by ChatGPT, they could commission ChatGPT to do so for free, rather than paying proper writers to do it. And obviously they believe that their readership wants proper writers to do literary criticism, that it is a job that requires a human sensibility and a human engagement with a text. I think there's no question that, even on the terms of the commission, nobody should be using AI to generate text for literary criticism.
Yeah, and Alexandra's, similarly for books, it would be something where the expectation of the reader would be that had wholly and completely, and I'm not necessarily talking about research here, but the actual prose itself had wholly and completely come from the mind of the author.
Well, I think everybody expects that, although people's expectations are shifting now with the advent of AI, and there's a lot of talk about books being written perfectly competently, but I think there are books in their books, and there's a huge difference between a genre, sort of low-level genre novel, and a higher-level literary book.
Mm. We had Tracy Chevalier on the programme not too long ago, and she's part of the group of authors who are starting to put a little logo on books to show that they were written by a human. But what she said, Alexandra, that was quite fascinating, was that she had tried, tested out AI and asked it to write in her style, and she said it didn't even manage to do that very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think AI can do quite a competent job at mimicking people, but whether they can do it over an entire book is another matter. And it's just actually not very interesting. I think one of the big problems with AI is the prose that it produces is slick and boring. And I think it's up to authors and their editors to be aware of it. And I think that authors probably there needs to be a clause in publishing contracts saying that AI won't be used for the prose. Of course, AI will be used for research, but that's a pretty dodgy tool because they get things wrong all the time at the moment.
Yeah. Is that sort of clause not there already?
No, not as far as I know, but I've not been within the industry for the last couple of years, so perhaps
it might be on its way.
But I haven't seen that. No.
Yeah, and Sam, you were touching on this when you talked about the conversation that you had with Alex Preston. But how much do you think people, as AI improves, and we know that it's improving all the time, that people will be tempted to try and just take off some of that workload by delegating some of that to AI?
Well, I think the temptation's obviously there, and the Alex Preston instance seems to me, if we're to accept his version of it at face value, to be a very stark indicator of how tempting it obviously is, even for writers, for whom the reputational risk is very high and, who don't need it. I mean, I think there's sort of two things to bear in mind here about the thing. One is that there is you know, this idea we have that, you know, you can always tell, or, you know, it can't produce proper writing. You know, you know, it seems a bit futile. You know, it's getting better and better and better. We know endlessly that people actually can be fooled by AI a lot. So how you detect it, AI detectors don't really work, is a really difficult practical problem. So I think where we have to hold the line is on the moral issue. We have to recognise, that the reputational risk of being caught out should be extremely high. We should recognise that all this stuff is the fruit of a poison tree. I mean, the kind of original sin of AI is it could not exist, these LLMs, without having stolen the work of writers without consent or compensation at scale. You know, they are plagiarism machines.
And that is one of the big lines of argument in this whole debate, isn't it? And certainly artists and creatives have been pushing back on that. I wonder, I mean, Alexandra, as a final thought, and this might be quite a purist thought, but if you are an author, if you have it in you, the dedication and the energy and the will to write books, to delegate some of that to a machine would just, I can't quite understand why, unless it comes down just to purely, you know, economics and time management.
I don't think there's such a thing as that, because if you want to write, then you have to go the distance, and it's a completely pointless thing. You have to learn to write. I'm writing my own book. It's been incredibly difficult, even though I was an editor for 40 years. You have to draft and redraft, and I teach writing. That's what we teach people to do. You know, it doesn't come in one go. You can't solve it quickly. It's a long and complicated and arduous process. And there's no point in doing it unless you really want to do it. Go and do something else. We don't need more books. You know, we're not asking people for books. You know, you have to passionately want to do it and to put the work in.
Thank you both. Really fascinating. Alexandra Pringle, who's a former editor-in-chief of Bloomsbury Publishing, and Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator. Thanks both.
Just coming up to 10 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinny McDonald, director of Theos, the religion and society think tank.
Good morning. I'm not sure I'd be capable of taking on a cosmic mission for the sake of humanity. Would you? This is the dilemma at the heart of the book-turned-Hollywood blockbuster Project Hail Mary. The film sees scientist Ryland Grace, played by Ryan Gosling, reluctantly propelled into a one-way space mission to find out what's eating the sun, and thereby stop the world ending in 30 years' time. The film title, Project Hail Mary, comes from the term in American football, in which a long, unlikely pass is made when all other options have failed. Grace, Ryland Grace, is humanity's last hope. In this week in which Artemis 2 makes its journey into space to orbit the moon, I'm reminded of the Hollywood drama and awe-inducing rhetoric of space travel. Speaking from aboard the Orion spacecraft yesterday, Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen said, "Humanity has once again shown what we are capable of." The space hero who gives their life for others is a familiar Hollywood trope. More generally, we hail heroes who flex their muscles and run towards danger in acts of bravery and strength. But it's the portrayal of Ryland Grace's lack of courage that is the most compelling moment of the film for me. When faced with the prospect of sacrificing himself by taking on the mission, he says no, that he can't do it, that he doesn't have it in him, that they should find someone else. There's a poignant moment in the Gospels in which Jesus, praying in the Garden of Gethsemane and knowing the painful death that is to befall him, prays to God that the cup of suffering might pass from him. This isn't a moment of bravado, but of deep and fragile humanity. For Christians, the crucifixion of Jesus is the ultimate cosmic act for the sake of humanity. Christ accepted the cup of suffering, giving himself for the sins of the world. But at its heart, this is a message not about courage and bravery, but about love. In these turbulent times, I think about whether a sacrifice might be asked of me sometime in the future, and worry I won't have the courage to step up when it matters, that I'll be found to be too scared, too safe, too self-preserving. In a scene in Project Hail Mary, an astronaut tells Ryland Grace, "It's easier to make a decision to be brave when we understand it as a necessary act of love, a being brave for someone else." Or he might have said, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends."
That was Thought for the Day with Chinny McDonald, director of Theos, that religion and society think tank. It's 8 minutes to eight.
Let's turn to the situation in Iran and specifically what is making the headlines this morning. A US fighter jet shot down by Iranian guns yesterday. We know that the pilot has been rescued, but there is still a missing crew member. And at the moment, there is this race going on between the Iranians and the Americans to try and find and locate that individual. We've heard that on Iranian state TV, citizens are being urged to look for them. They're being offered a cash reward. Obviously, the US are doing what they can to try and get them back. It is one story which is dominating the headlines this morning, but the repercussions that could come from that, particularly the diplomatic repercussions, are important. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, joins us. Lise, give us a bit of wider context, because people might say this is one individual and many are suffering and are part of this war. But it is the wider implications of this and what this moment could do to the passage of the war, isn't it, that makes it important?
Good morning. It is. It is one individual, one American crewman in a wide, wide war, which is causing a great deal of destruction, devastation, desperation, suffering among civilians across many countries. But this is one of the worst moments in any war for warring parties. It is fraught with risk. Risk, first of all, to try to rescue this crewman. American forces prepare all through their careers for this moment, but it's still very risky. It is also fraught with political risk for the White House, for President Trump. If it is Iran which finds this pilot, and if this pilot is then paraded on TV and the photos, the videos will be splashed across social media, this will be a huge propaganda victory for Iran. And remember, we're entering the sixth week of this war, but also a huge humiliation for the United States and, of course, huge distress for the crewman. President Trump is said to be hunkered down in the White House. And given what we know of President Trump, I think this moment will give real meaning to the name of this U.S. military operation, which is called Epic Fury. He hears again and again, he sees the videos which are presented to him again and again, and there's a lot of truth to the videos that, yes, they have achieved significant military victories. But his defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, had been telling the world that the U.S. military had achieved total air dominance. This incident, the shooting down of the fighter jet, and we understand a Black Hawk as well during the rescue mission. There's a concern, one still questions about the A-10. It also crashed. Underlines that yes, Iran's military capabilities have been diminished, but they are not gone. And don't forget, this comes after his primetime address on Wednesday night, where it was clear from his comments, again, more contradictory comments about what this was all about and when it will end, that there is still no clear path out of this war. And in this moment, Anna, the question will be, as it is always with President Trump, whenever he faces a problem of this nature, is who has the president's ear? Pete Hegseth has just fired the Army Chief of Staff, one of the most experienced military people, a person he could have called upon, although it doesn't seem as though the military are the people he calls on the most. We've got, just to take one example of someone who's had his ear, Laura Loomer, who is a far-right-wing political activist. We have seen over the past year that when she whispers in President Trump's ear, it's resulted in sackings. She has now posted on social media that they now have to make good on that threat to bomb Iran back, as President Trump put it, in the Stone Ages, in the plural. She says we have to carpet bomb Iran. We have to go after every nicety of a modern day society. We have to make the Iranians beg for humanitarian aid. God help the world, if that is who he's going to be listening to. But it will be one of many voices. But for the moment, the focus is on finding that crewman, and we can just begin to imagine the kind of, if he's still alive, the kind of stress this he must be going through.
Yeah, Lise Doucette, thank you very much, as always, our chief international correspondent. We will speak after the news a little more about the details of that search. As Lise was saying, the complexity of it and the importance of it as well is still to come.
3 minutes to 8. Across the next few days, we're remembering a legendary playwright.
Celebrating Stoppard on BBC Radio 4.
What Tom Stoppard loved about radio was outrageous freedom.
Your student confesses to being a witch. One wonders where she gets it from.
3 days of documentaries and dramas.
Mr. Boot, would you mind stepping down to the end of the counter?
Spanning the life and work of one of Britain's greatest modern playwrights.
When I glance up, I can see him frowning at me and then at the canvas as if one of us has misbehaved.
A phenomenal raconteur and the driest wit that I have ever met in my life.
Celebrating Stoppard this Saturday, Sunday and Monday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And the weekend's drama begins with Stoppard's first radio play, written in 1964. Derek Fold stars in The Dissolution of Dominic Boot this morning at 10:15.
Let's take a look at the weather now. There's a lot you need to know later in the day. In particular, Louise Lee is here. Morning, Louise.
Beautifully put, Anna. Good morning. I'm glad somebody's listening because it's really difficult to try to get that balance with the weather because actually there's going to be a lot of good weather this Easter weekend. There's also some stormy weather around as well. So actually not a bad start. Actually dry with some sunshine across eastern Scotland, eastern England. We'll keep some sunshine as well today across East Anglia, South East England, and it'll be pleasantly warm. Highs expected of 17 degrees. But yes, it's clouding over from the west and the winds will strengthen. And we've got some light drizzly rain. Now, as we go through the afternoon into the evening, this is when Storm Dave arrives. It's going to bring gusts of winds widely in excess of 60 miles an hour to Scotland, to Northern Ireland, possibly as much as 80 to 90 mile an hour gusts through the night. It'll bring a spell of heavy rain. We could see 50 millimetres falling through the night. Some snow, so blizzard-like conditions to the tops of the mountains. But it sweeps away very quickly. And into Easter Sunday, sunny spells, scattered showers. If you dodge the showers, it'll be a pleasant day. Not as warm as today, highs of 7 to 12 degrees. But warmer still as we go into Monday. Easter Monday will be dry, settled and relatively sunny. There you go.
Thank you, Louise. We're all listening, you know. It's not just Anna, but you are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Sean Farrington.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 4th of April. The headlines this morning, US and Iranian forces are searching for a missing American crew member after a fighter jet was shot down by Tehran. 5 police officers have been taken off frontline duties after a bag of guns issued by Scotland Yard was found on a street in London. And 3 people have been charged over an arson attack on ambulances owned by a Jewish charity.
Coming up in the next hour, teachers are warning that online misogyny is spilling into classrooms with abuse against female staff rising. We'll hear about some of the efforts to tackle it. And,
you know, it's great to think that with the exception of our 4 friends, all of us are represented in this image.
The Artemis astronauts, now halfway to the moon, have been sending back stunning pictures of our planet.
And I'm Jane Dougal with your Saturday Sport. We're looking forward to a big match in the FA Cup quarterfinals. First kickoff is at the Etihad, where Manchester City host Liverpool. And their manager, Arne Slot, says his fans will bring the noise.
The good thing is it's an FA Cup tie, so we have more fans than we usually have in an away game. And as we know from our fans, they will be loud. And I wouldn't be surprised if they would even be louder than the fans of City.
The BBC News this morning is read by Alan Smith.
Iran and the US are racing to find the missing crew member of a downed American fighter jet. Tehran says it shot down the F-15 over the southwest of the country yesterday and that soldiers are now combing the area. US officials have told the BBC's partner network CBS News that the other person in the aircraft has been rescued. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalawasho reports from Washington.
This is the first known case of a U.S. military aircraft being shut down over Iran during this war. President Trump had claimed that Iran couldn't do a thing about American aircraft operating over its territory and that its air defenses had been significantly weakened. Iran's Revolutionary Guard is now said to have sealed off a huge area and begun a search for the missing U.S. service personnel, turning this into a high-stakes race on the ground between the two adversaries. In a further blow to Washington, Iran claims to have shot down a second U.S. warplane. U.S. media say the A-10 Warthog was targeted near the Strait of Hormuz during a search and rescue mission for the first downed aircraft. The pilot ejected and was rescued. President Trump insisted last night that the loss of the F-15 would not affect negotiations with Iran, saying it's war.
Iran has executed two men accused of links to an opposition group. State media claims they had carried out armed attacks. Rights groups have expressed concern that Tehran is using the war as a cover-up for a surge in executions. The Metropolitan Police has removed five officers from frontline duties after a bag of guns issued by the force was reportedly left outside the home of the mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan. Scotland Yard said it believed the weapons were misplaced. Greg McKenzie reports.
A bag containing Metropolitan Police firearms, reportedly including a submachine gun, a taser and ammunition, has been recovered after being found on a South London street. A local man, Jordan Griffiths, said his partner discovered the bag by the curb on Tuesday evening. He told the Sun newspaper he was shocked by its contents and immediately contacted police. Officers arrived within minutes to retrieve the weapons. The Metropolitan Police say the bag is believed to have been misplaced by on-duty officers. Five officers have been removed from frontline duties, and the force says an urgent internal review is now underway. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London described it as a very serious incident and said the Met should take all steps to ensure it never happened again.
Three people have been charged after an arson attack destroyed four ambulances in northwest London. The vehicles belonging to a Jewish charity were set on fire in Golders Green. The suspects are due to appear before magistrates today. More details from our special correspondent Lucy Manning.
The Crown Prosecution Service said it had charged 20-year-old Hamza Iqbal, 19-year-old Rayhan Khan and a 17-year-old who can't be named for legal reasons with arson, with intent to damage property and being reckless as to whether life would be endangered. The ambulances were set on fire last week in the grounds of a synagogue car park. Oxygen canisters inside the vehicles caused explosions which damaged nearby buildings. The ambulances were run by the voluntary Jewish group Hatzolah, which treats patients of any religion. The three suspects were arrested on Wednesday and their addresses were searched. The Metropolitan Police says Hamza Iqbal and Rayhan Khan are British nationals from Leyton and the unnamed 17-year-old is a dual British Pakistani national from Walthamstow. Scotland Yard said although the investigation was being led by counter-terror policing, it had not yet been declared a terrorism incident.
The NASUWT teaching union has warned there is a masculinity crisis brewing in schools. A survey of its members suggests the percentage of female teachers facing misogyny from pupils has risen for the fourth year in a row. Here's our education reporter, Kate McGough.
What's become known as the Manosphere is a loose network of online communities and influencers targeting male audiences that claims to address men's struggles around things such as dating or fitness. But often it also promotes misogynistic attitudes. The teaching union, the NASUWT, questioned 5,000 of its members ahead of its conference this weekend. Nearly a quarter of the female teachers who responded said they'd experienced misogyny from a pupil in the last year, the highest proportion in 4 years. The government is currently consulting on whether or not to ban social media for under-16s, and it's recently issued new guidance for teachers on how to help pupils recognise and challenge misogyny. But the union wants to see more training on how to tackle this in the classroom.
Astronauts on NASA's Artemis 2 mission are now more than halfway to the moon, more than 130,000 miles from Earth, and are on course to fly past it on Monday evening. They've sent back some of the most detailed pictures yet of their journey, including a stunning image of our planet that's been named Hello World. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh is following the mission from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
In the latest image sent back by the Artemis 2 crew, the entire Earth hangs luminous in the blackness of space. Deep blue oceans, swirling white clouds and a bright atmosphere give it the appearance of a shimmering jewelled marble. It's an echo of the first colour photograph of Earth taken by the astronauts of Apollo 8 in 1968, an image that provided a moment of hope and optimism to a divided and war-torn world. And perhaps the new picture might have the same effect. There'll be more spectacular images as the Orion spacecraft hurtles towards its destination, with our world getting progressively smaller and the moon becoming larger and revealing new details of the lunar landscape.
Donald Trump has asked Congress for around $150 million to reopen Alcatraz Prison in California. The US president first floated the idea last year on social media and is now requesting the funding as part of the latest White House budget proposal. Alcatraz is one of San Francisco's biggest tourist attractions after closing as a prison in 1963. US media say government officials believe a full reopening as a maximum security facility would cost around $2 billion. Conservationists say the UK's first modern herd of bison, introduced in Kent 4 years ago, is already having a great impact on their woodland home. New bison bridges, funded in part by the Postcode Lottery, are now being opened to give the animals a much larger area to roam, as Rebecca Drought reports.
Ancient steppe bison would have roamed Britain thousands of years ago. Their closest modern relative, European bison, were introduced to the Blean Woods near Canterbury in 2022. It was hoped the animal's natural behaviour, grazing, felling trees and eating bark, would help to restore complex habitats, in turn to allow nature to both thrive and be more able to cope with climate change. The herd of four were initially kept in a fenced 50-hectare enclosure. Since then, seven calves have been born. The matriarch died last year and six have been moved to other conservation projects. The Kent Wildlife Trust and Wildwood Kent, which are behind the project, say it's already having a positive effect. The bison are now being given access to up to 200 hectares of land, thanks to bridges, which allow the herd to move under existing footpaths without preventing public access.
A man from South Wales who's climbed the region's highest peak 15 times a week for the past year will finish his challenge this morning. Chris Daniel has raised thousands of pounds for charity by going up and down Penavan. Rebecca Miles reports.
Known on social media as Penavan Dan, Chris Daniel started his hiking challenge last April. He's been taking this same route from the Pontardav car park up to the peak at 886 metres and back down again, 15 times a week. He's been raising money for Bowel Cancer UK in memory of his wife Rita, who died from the disease 10 years ago. He's now raised almost £20,000 and he broke the record for the number of climbs up Penavan in 1 year in the first 6 months. Today he'll take the same route, but this time he's expecting around 100 friends and family to join him.
That report was from Rebecca Miles.
Thank you, Alan. It's 10 minutes past eight. That is the sound of a search for a missing crew member from a US fighter jet that came down over Iran. Right now, there is a race to locate that weapons officer after the pilot was rescued yesterday. And what you heard there was Iranians on the ground hunting through scrubland, urged on by state-affiliated TV channels.
If you capture an enemy pilot and hand them over alive to the military or law enforcement, you will be given a suitable reward.
Well, at the same time, the American military is doing what it can to find its missing member, flying sorties low over the ground in the south of Iran. It is one person. It's one life. It's in a war that's affecting millions across the Middle East. But this is a moment that could have far-reaching diplomatic implications, depending on who finds that downed weapons officer and what happens to them next. Well, Laurel Rapp is director of the US and North America program at Chatham House, served as deputy director of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff until 2025. Laurel, good morning.
Good morning.
Just give us a bit more of the wider context of this. As we were touching on there, this search is going on both sides. But what does it mean to both the US and to Iran to find that crew member first?
For the US, this is a critical mission. The US military right now is embarking on a very complex search and rescue mission for one US airman lost in southwest Iran. The second airman did eject and was located by U.S. forces. So there is one remaining on the ground in Iran. And as you noticed, the Iranians have put out a bounty for this person. This would be a huge prize for them if this airman is captured by Iran. Iran has embarked upon, since its inception, this regime has embarked upon hostage taking, seeking American citizens and other foreign nationals as leverage and as bargaining chips in negotiations. At its inception in 1979, it took over 50 U.S. diplomats hostage, and that was a very powerful bargaining chip that they had against the United States. And so the stakes are very, very high on both sides. The U.S. is going to do whatever it can to get this U.S. airman back, and it is a very dangerous couple of hours and days ahead.
Yeah, as you say, it is the sort of thing that can have a material impact on the way that this war is being fought and the decisions that are being made next, because it's something, as you say, if that person is found by the Iranians, perhaps if they appear on TV, it is something quite visceral, which has an impact on the public's perception of the war. And that is the kind of thing that, well, leaders certainly in the US will listen to.
That's right. This war has been unpopular from the start among the American people. A majority of Americans do not support U.S. military action in Iran, do not support the path President Trump is undertaking here. And so we will see what the disposition of this airman is in the coming hours, hopefully days. But if those images were to come forward, those would be incredibly sort of shifting from an American viewpoint perspective. The costs are real here. The American people are beginning to feel the costs of this war 5 weeks in. It is hitting principally on American wallets. The cost of energy, of oil and gas, has been rising consistently over these past 5 weeks. As the Strait of Hormuz closes, there are inflationary fears as well in the United States, which will take a little bit longer to see. But now, if this were to be the next piece of the rising cost, is this a very public effect on U.S. military? We have seen the loss of 13 U.S. military members over the course of the past 5 weeks. And we will see if this next piece, this search and rescue, is able to quickly resolve and bring this U.S. service member back, under U.S. force control, or if this individual remains missing. And as I mentioned, this would provide a huge piece of leverage that Iran would seek to use in a negotiation to end this conflict. That's not a position the Americans want to be in here.
Laurel, I would never ask you to predict what's going to happen next, because we all know that this is a deeply unpredictable conflict. But from the US perspective, there are, again, two options forward, really. One would be to use this as a de-escalatory moment, and one would be to use it to justify something like a ground operation, for example. Just talk us through what those two scenarios might look like.
So there has been rumored conversations about ground troops in Iran. The question is, what is the mission? If the mission is a very limited U.S. military search and rescue operation, that is one thing. If it is others that President Trump has discussed about seeking to secure some of Iran's enriched uranium, that is a different mission. There is then the much more expansive mission of other goals and other capabilities Trump has sought to erode, which he'd mentioned, everywhere from ballistic missiles to Iranian proxies to the regime itself. And so the mission matters here in terms of the level of risk and the willingness the U.S. administration will be interested in pursuing here. The search and rescue will continue for as long as it takes to secure this individual. And that has been a feature of the way the U.S. has waged war going back since its inception, right? So that will be no different here. But there will also be this competing question about the direction this war takes from here. Will it be a de-escalatory moment? The risk here is that de-escalating at a moment in the U.S. administration's eyes could signal that hostage taking, if that is where this this trajectory goes, offers leverage. And that is not a message the U.S. will want to send to Iran or to any country that would seek to capture U.S. service members or U.S. civilians. And so right now, the goals of this operation, they've been unclear from the start, shifting goals and shifting objectives. The goals remain unclear and are becoming increasingly complex because we've not only added the four initial goals that President Trump has set out on ballistic missiles, on nuclear, on regional proxies, and on the regime itself. This 5-week conflict has also added the complexity of the Strait of Hormuz closing, and now that being a U.S. military objective that President Trump seeks to address. And now this question about the status of the U.S. service member. And so there is no clear and easy off-ramp here. I think you will see voices potentially in the administration, absolutely within the American people and in Congress, that the costs and the risks of this conflict have become too high. They're too steep. Yeah. And if there is an escalation beyond, the U.S. is, the risk is that the U.S. is pulled deeper and deeper into this conflict that shows no easy signs of wrapping up.
Yeah. Laurel Rapp, thank you so much. Director of the U.S. and North America program at Chatham House.
18 minutes past eight. There's been a new reason to check our phones repeatedly these last few days, hasn't there? How are the astronauts on Artemis 2 getting on? Are they around the moon yet? Is the toilet working? Have they sent photos back yet? Well, yes, they have. Halfway to the moon now. Mission Commander Reid Wiseman has got his high-resolution camera out and sent back some images of Earth, described here by Lakeisha Hawkins, who's NASA's Deputy Director for the Artemis program.
This first one we got to the ground shows the unique vantage point of the crew as they look back at the Earth. It shows a backlit Earth revealing auroras as the crew heads towards the moon. It was taken by Reid Wiseman out of an Orion window, and it features two auroras, top right and left and bottom left, and zodiacal light, which is at the bottom right. It's visible as the Earth eclipses to sun. You know, it's great to think that with the exception of our four friends, all of us are represented in this image.
We've got Helen Sharman with us, the first British astronaut to ever go to space back in 1991. Helen, good morning. These images always feel like a crucial moment, don't they? Why are they so important in these missions?
Oh, good morning. Yes, I mean, it's important, I think, for lots of reasons. But when we see what the astronauts are seeing with their eyes, it really puts us there. I think it enables us to get much more of a feel for what's going on. And of course, we've always liked to look back at the Earth, and wherever we go in life, you know, we like to look back, whether it's metaphorically or physically. And I think it gives us a different perspective. It allows us to consider really where we are in this vast universe.
We know they're halfway to the moon at the moment-ish. What will the astronauts be doing at this time?
Well, they're having a bit of a more gentle day today. They've been doing some CPR work, so they've been looking at how they can resuscitate people in not just in weightless conditions, which of course has been done on the International Space Station, but in the really cramped environment of the Orion spacecraft. Imagine trying to do chest compressions without having the weight of your own body to be able to push down on somebody. Yeah, so you need to do sort of a handstand using your feet on the ceiling, or perhaps wrap your legs around their chest to squeeze them tightly. There are different techniques, so it's not simple. It's not a trivial thing to do. But they'll have been doing some of that testing and starting to get their head around what they're going to see on the moon and what they need to do there. Also some other experiments on board the space station. So experiments generally to do with radiation. I'm really interested in one that's all about the immune system. So how being in space, including radiation, impacts astronauts' immune systems, both sometimes heightens it and can give rise to allergies, but also sometimes seems to depress it. So dormant viruses like shingles, for instance, can play up. So yeah, really interesting.
A reminder, isn't it, of how much stuff is taken from these missions. So that's some of the things you're interested in, maybe longer term consequences and findings from that. Is there anything, as you watch the journey, you know, it's only a 10-day trip. Is there a moment you're looking forward to that we need to keep our eye out for?
Well, I think all astronauts would say it's having a soft landing, even though they're going to be splashing down. But yeah, of course, I mean, it's this lunar flyby, isn't it, which we're waiting for in a couple of days. Yeah, really exciting. And particularly now we know that they're going to be experiencing for about an hour while they are around the other side of the moon, they'll be experiencing a solar eclipse. So the Earth will get between the moon and the sun. They'll be able to see the sun's corona around the edge of the moon, and they'll be able to look for meteoroid impacts, so little flashes of light where a meteorite has hit the moon, plumes of lunar dust, for instance. So I think that's going to be particularly interesting.
So there could be some more good photos coming out of that. Do you notice there's a bit of a difference, our relationship with space now from when you went on your journey in 1991, that actually all of this isn't that far away from our day-to-day lives anymore? The reliance on whether it's communication, potential factories in space one day, tourism, whatever it might be.
I think you're right. We do think of space as being much metaphorically closer to us on Earth now. If we're asked, we know that, you know, you need satellites to operate the navigation system in our phones, but we don't often think about it. We just accept it. Financial transactions, you know, the whole finance industry is so reliant on precise timing from satellites in space. But yes, the whole idea that it's going to be more accessible for humans, and that space data is being used more accessibly as well. It really democratizes that whole use of space. People around the world, people who are not terribly wealthy, can actually make use of space. You don't have to be a billionaire and pay for your own space flight.
Helen, thank you. Helen Sharman, the first British astronaut to ever go to space.
I'm always entranced by Helen Sharman. I could listen to her talk all day. It's time for the sport. Jane Dougal's with us here in Salford this morning. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Sean. Well, we are building up to the FA Cup quarterfinals, and arguably the biggest tie of the weekend is Manchester City and Liverpool, who meet at the Etihad in the lunchtime game. And who better to analyse that one but former Manchester City and Liverpool keeper David James, who I'm very pleased to say joins us now. David, welcome. Does the result depend upon which Liverpool turns up? They have been so inconsistent this season.
Good morning, Jane. This season, obviously, has been very difficult for Liverpool with the results, as you mentioned there, especially the great start to the sort of very downturn. I think the focus is where Liverpool's question will be, and if the focus is right, the right Liverpool turn up, then this will be one terrific game, especially with the way the Manchester City can play. So I think they'll be focused, and I think we'll be in for a cracker today.
Well, yes, because Liverpool manager Arne Slot could be thinking, I've got a big week ahead of me with Champions League quarterfinal against PSG coming up, Paris Saint-Germain. Or will he be thinking that the FA Cup could be Liverpool's best chance for silverware?
It's funny you asked that question, because it reminds me of the question asked about Man City a couple of weeks ago in a very similar way when they were playing Arsenal in the Carabao Cup final. I think they only think about this game today. They can't afford to think about Paris Saint-Germain midweek, because if they try and think about two games at once, and that will just let City straight in, and then this game will be done and City will be through. So total focus on today, looking to get the win and get to Wembley for the semi-final.
Well, Manchester City, as you mentioned, they're second in the league, nine points behind Arsenal. They already have a trophy, as you mentioned, after winning the League Cup. You wouldn't bet against them today, would you?
I didn't actually think they would win that cup final, given what had happened and how Arsenal were, but they turned up, won the game quite convincingly in the end. And again, that's why I think today will be a cracker, because Man City will focus just on one game and getting to Wembley for the semi-final.
And fans, Liverpool fans, might be losing patience with Arne Slot. So, you know, a trophy could give him a lifeline. So Liverpool are probably going to throw everything at Manchester City.
Yeah, I wanted to mention Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because I think Liverpool and Man City are the same. They're not like normal teams. They just need feeding. They need, well, I say that in a sense, they need feeding trophies. Liverpool fans, I'm sure, will get on Arne's side again, or the ones who aren't quite with him at the moment, if they can bring a trophy home, if it's the FA Cup, if it's Champions League. And yes, the FA Cup is a desirable trophy for Liverpool. So that's what Arne will be.
Sorry, David, I don't know whether you're still there or not. I'll ask you another. So City out of the Champions League after a comprehensive defeat to Real Madrid. So they will be looking for a domestic treble, trying to get to top of the table, trying to beat Arsenal, trying to get to the final, as you say, for the FA Cup final. I think we've lost David James, unfortunately, but that match coming up lunchtime on BBC. The other FA Cup quarterfinals today as well. Chelsea host Port Vale. And also Premier League leaders, as we mentioned, travel to Southampton later. There's a huge night of boxing ahead on the BBC too, with Welsh Olympic gold medalist Lauren Price putting her belts on the line tonight. She faces Puerto Rican Stephanie Pinheiro at the Cardiff Arena. The unbeaten pair will meet for the WBC, WBA and IBF welterweight world titles. They are all held by Price, and they are on the undercard of the heavyweight fight between Derek Chisora and Deontay Wilder. Coverage on a big night of boxing in Cardiff, all on BBC Two and BBC iPlayer from 6 p.m.
Thank you, Jane. Saturday Live coming up here on Radio 4. Let's find out what's in store. Adrian Charles, good morning to you.
Hi, Sean. You're right. Thanks. Thanks very much. Yes, Saturday Live from 9 o'clock. We have got Bear Grylls with us. An astonishing character, obviously survived all sorts of stuff. Likes a challenge. He's now actually done a highly successful rewrite of nothing less than The Story of Jesus, an ambitious project. It's gone down very well. Also, we've got Chris Roberts, a.k.a. Flame Baster, an extraordinary character from North Wales, a travelling chef with an incredible story to tell. And we've got the composer Liz Lane, a prodigy. She was composing at the age of six. She's gone on to do some amazing work, often with brass bands, and looking forward to speaking to her. And we'll have the inheritance tracks of Leslie Joseph.
A beautifully eclectic, as always. Thank you, Adrian. They're on the way from 9 o'clock this morning. The weather today will start, well, it's not too bad this morning, depending on where you are, but overnight and later on today, Storm Dave is approaching from the west, so expect gale force winds, heavy rain and hill snow as well if you're in the north or the west of the country.
The time is just coming up to 8:30. We are looking for the news now with, of course, it is today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Sean Farrington. And let us get the summary of the news with Alan Smith.
US and Iranian forces are in a race to find the missing crew member of a downed American fighter jet. State media in Iran says a valuable reward is on offer if the weapons system officer is captured alive. US officials have told the BBC's partner network CBS News that the other person in the aircraft has been rescued. The Metropolitan Police says it's investigating how a bag of guns issued by the force was left on a street in London, reportedly near the home of the city's mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan. A member of the public called police after discovering the firearms. Three people have been charged with arson after four ambulances operated by a Jewish charity were destroyed in a fire in northwest London last week. Two British men, aged 19 and 20, and a 17-year-old boy who has dual British-Pakistani national, are due to appear before magistrates today. And NASA says the astronauts on the Artemis 2 mission have passed the halfway point to their destination. The capsule is scheduled to circle the moon on Monday.
Thank you, Alan. It's 8:30, just over a month to go now until local elections and votes in Scotland and Wales as well. And we've been looking at how the main parties are planning to tackle the rising cost of living and how they're planning to sell that to you and hopefully get your vote in a few weeks' time. Rachel Millward joins us, Deputy Leader of the Green Party of England and Wales. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Hope you are as well. People are seeing the real impact, aren't they, particularly of the war in the Middle East at the moment. They are thinking about how to cast their vote in a few weeks' time, and the cost of living, particularly the cost of energy bills, the cost of filling a car, that is right at the forefront of people's minds. So how are you planning to win people over in that respect?
Well, it certainly is a really stressful time for most households, isn't it? I mean, we were already before the war, I think, feeling the incredible stretch with bills going up and up in all regards. And what we think is so important is that families have certainty at this point and that we do guarantee a continuation of this energy price cap come July. So at the moment, as I'm sure people know, those bills might well go up £300 in July. And it's our belief that that shouldn't happen because ordinary people shouldn't be paying for this illegal and unnecessary war. And that's what happens at the moment. So we do need to do that. We would pay for that through making sure that windfall taxes were tightened up. So at the moment, you know, gas and oil companies are profiteering from this war considerably. And we need to be clawing back those profits into our economy so that it isn't ordinary people who are paying for it. We also believe in measures like equalising capital gains tax with income tax. Basically, that means that we think that ordinary working people, your work should not be taxed more than the money that assets create whilst people sleep, effectively. So it's a fairer model that would raise quite a lot.
One of the difficulties at the moment, and this is where the Green Party stands apart from the others, is the diversification of where we get our energy from. So you've got other parties talking about developing Jackdaw and Rosebank, the gas and oil fields. Mm. That is very much not your policy. And at a moment like this, where people are saying, look, people might want to vote for you. They appreciate that the climate crisis is real, but also saying, I just can't afford to do it just now. How will you sell that to people who say, I cannot afford the cost of living? I cannot vote for the Green Party because they will make my cost of living more expensive?
Well, it's the opposite is the reality. So, you know, all the research has shown, this is Oxford University research, that even if we did all the drilling we could do in the North Sea, the maximum would reduce bills by is about £82 a year. Whereas if we go for renewables and we really invest in that so much more, we could be bringing bills down by £300 a year.
But the difficulty plus is that's the future, isn't it? That's not right now.
Mm. Well, what we have right now is an opportunity to develop our green economy. Actually, if you look at Spain, they have doubled their renewables and their bills have gone from some of the highest in Europe to some of the lowest. We can move really, really fast on this. We know that. I mean, Ed Miliband knows it. Labour know it. They've said it very clearly.
Infrastructure is time consuming, isn't it? It's, you know, to move to renewables, it can take decades to put that in place. And even people who agree with you, you know, even people who say that is what we need to do, the facts on the ground make that enormously difficult at the moment as a policy, don't they?
Well, the facts on the ground actually are, again, that investing in renewables is the right thing to do. It will bring inward investment into the UK. So it gives us this chance to become a world leader and to take much more investment. And actually, it's beyond short-sighted, really, to be investing in oil and gas because it leaves us vulnerable to the energy shocks that we're seeing at the moment. You know, we need energy sovereignty as a nation. We need to have that independence and we need that for the future. So the green economy will bring so many more jobs and it will bring bills down and it can do it very, very fast.
I wanted to ask you about a story in the Daily Mail this morning. Now, they say that the Green Party that you're calling for a 55 mile an hour limit on motorways. Obviously, the Mail has a particular editorial direction on that. They call it a war on motorists. Is that correct? Is that Green Party policy that you will reduce motorway speed limits to 55 miles an hour?
I'm actually not aware of that policy. Now, that may or may not be somewhere. Our policy is it's chosen by members. It goes through a kind of conference process and is voted in. I'm not sure about that. But what I would say is that we passionately believe that public transport, the active travel needs so much more investment. And that would make a huge difference to ordinary people's lives.
To be clear, you're saying that might be part of the policy, but you are the deputy leader. That's if you were, you know, lower down, I might not expect you to know, but you are the deputy leader. So you don't even know if that's something that's being discussed, that's in the policy.
Well, it's certainly not one of our leading policies at this point. There are policies that have been developed over time through the party. I'm not quite sure where the Daily Mail's got that from, but it's certainly not something we're campaigning on in this election. What we are campaigning on, however, is clear and consistent investment in public transport. Like, I'm co-leader of a council down in Sussex. You can barely get across the district in public transport at all. So people are car dependent unnecessarily. We would be giving free bus fares for the under 21s. We would also consider things like a bus ticket price cap at £2, all this kind of thing would make a massive difference. And every time you spend in the net zero economy, every time you spend a pound, you get £3 or £4 back into the economy and other kind of benefits. So cleaner air, you know, a better, more active life for people. So there's all kinds of reasons to do that, but it's the way forward for our economy.
Fine. So those are things that are coming before the election, but the motorway speed limit, not necessarily so. Rachel Millward, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for joining us, the Deputy Leader of the Green Party of England and Wales.
Just gone 23 minutes to nine. Now, when the average price of filling up the petrol or diesel tank rises by the most in a month on record, as it has done, and expectations that energy bills are going to shoot up this summer, many of the questions of government are who's going to get support now. But there will be a longer term impact from juggling those levels of support, the pressure to increase defence spending, the desires to grow the economy, all with the Chancellor's desires to continue to meet her own rules about how much the country borrows in the longer term. Stephanie Flanders is with us, Senior Executive Editor for Economics at Bloomberg, head of Bloomberg Economics as well. Stephanie, good morning.
Morning, Sean.
Jonathan Haskell as well, Professor of Economics at Imperial College Business School, former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. Hi, Jonathan.
Morning, Sean.
Now, I'd like to chat to you both a little bit about maybe what some of those longer term impacts might be. People might be thinking about the next couple of months, but the consequences of some of the decisions that are being made right now. Stephanie, what are the big things, do you think, that need to be considered in the long run as people call for support right now?
Well, I mean, as you're sort of juggling even in that question between the two, I mean, as ever, what lessons people draw from this will end up being shaped by how long it continues, what the impact actually was on the economy. Those are uncertainties that we're sort of grappling with in our forecast. You know, we're already seeing inflation affecting it, being affected, probably adding about half a percentage point already to the March inflation rate. And then we'll also be looking at a growth hit that comes from this. But, you know, how it feeds through the economy will depend an enormous amount on how long the conflict continues and how long it takes for, you know, if anything like back to normal on the Strait of Hormuz, which looks very far away at this point. And the reason I say that is, you know, not just because we're obviously seeing impact on gas prices and oil prices that we can get into, but, you know, one of the things that we've seen, we've been particularly affected by, is the ramping up of refined products. You know, actually only oil refiners buy crude oil. You know, and we always hear about the Brent crude price, but what's actually bought by the rest of the economy, by individuals and by companies, is always the refined products like diesel and things like kerosene, sort of jet fuel. And that those prices have gone up much more than Brent crude because of the sort of physical shortage aspect. And we're pretty vulnerable to that. So we tend to talk about a vulnerability on the gas side, but we are very vulnerable and have very low reliant on Middle East imports for those kind of refined products, along with France. So, you know, there's a lot of unexpected things that we may find down the line we want to think about a little bit more that go beyond the discussions we often have about reliant on gas and the fact that we are affected so quickly by foreign gas price increases.
Jonathan, if some of those things do linger for longer, where are your biggest concerns?
Thank you, Sean. And I agree with Stephanie. Those are clearly set out set of concerns here. But in the more medium term, let me sound a slightly more optimistic note, Sean, if I may. If you'll allow me to use an Artemis II analogy, as far as monetary policy is concerned, we're not on the dark side of the moon here. We have actually explored the territory of big oil price shocks and how they feed through to the rest of the economy. And we do have an independent central bank with a clear inflation mandate. And I think what that means is that in the medium term, it's not likely that we're going to have sort of locked in inflation as we did in the 1970s, because that's the power, I think, of having an independent central bank. So let me try to be a little bit more optimistic, perhaps. But of course, that is not to minimize the short term difficulties that the economy is going to be in as oil prices rise and energy prices for households might rise as well, just as Stephanie was just saying.
Within all of this, though, Stephanie, how do you get growth? We heard those ambitions for a few years now, but if you're seeing energy price spikes and talk of more support and pressures to increase spending elsewhere on the likes of defence, what is needed within that to give, you know, the businesses we speak to every day on this programme the confidence that they can come out of 2026 better than they started it? We had a bit of that in January, but that feels like that's dissipated a bit now.
Look, I think there's two levels to this. I mean, at one level, we are all subject to the uncertain impacts of this war that pretty much nobody wanted, or at least and very few people even now understand. But if you're just looking domestically at the economy, I mean, I would sound also a note of sort of context relative to even the invasion of Ukraine and the impact that that had on our economy. You know, just, you know, the gas is obviously something we think about a lot, and we're sort of immediately thinking in terms of a similar sized impact. But it's a much smaller, it's only in fact 3% of total gas consumption in the world that's affected by this. It's oil is much more affected. So it's about a tenth of the impact of that 2022 shock on households, if you're just thinking about that cost, the increase in utility bills, energy bills. So when people are thinking about, oh, that energy price, you know, number is going to go up in July and then the government's going to be under pressure, we're talking about much smaller numbers, and the amount being taken out of households is much smaller than that, about a tenth of 2022. So it is true that the government was hoping that various things were going to come into place this year, and given a sort of slightly, you know, smaller amount of leeway anyway, that's going to be affected by this shock, but it is not of the same magnitude unless we see something very dramatic happen. And, you know, I think that is also a source of positivity. There were things that were coming into place. You know, the government would talk to things like the infrastructure bill, infrastructure and planning bill, which was only actually passed into law at the end of this year. So they would hope to see some of that come through this year. There are things that can still happen. This isn't a sort of all consuming shock, like I'm afraid the several that we've had in the last few years, including COVID and also 2022.
So, Jonathan, is there a risk that people behave because of the financial traumas their households may have gone through, and businesses behave as if these shocks that might be coming are going to be on the scale of whatever we saw through COVID and the peaks of the energy prices, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine? Do you see behaviours as if that might happen, even though it might not be warranted?
That's an interesting point, Sean, and I think we could try to be a bit positive about that. You know, businesses are under constant pressure to evolve and to adapt under the force of competition, which means that they've got to do that. So I think they will be forward looking, and unless, as Stephanie was saying, this crisis goes on for a very long time, they'll adapt to a new environment when hopefully things get back to normal. But in terms of encouraging growth, I think therefore what they're going to be doing, Sean, is to look at more in the medium term. They're going to look at things like public investment in science and how that might be helpful for businesses developing new products. They're going to look at the business environment, and they're going to look at the planning environment, because that affects the formation of new clusters, which are the areas where new technology kind of bubbles up. And so all of that is in the context, of course, of the coming AI revolution. The hope would be that if we can get those policies right in those areas, we can convert that AI revolution into productivity growth in the economy all round.
Stephanie, people might be surprised to sort of hear the glimmers of optimism from yourself and Jonathan as you sort of try, and it's never easy to try and look into that crystal ball, as there's so much uncertainty at the minute. Does there need to be a bit more positivity from those who are speaking about this and speaking to the nation about the consequences of this more often?
I think it's funny. I'm wondering whether it's just the effect of the sort of Easter Bunny or something. We've just heard there's been so much gloom over the last couple of weeks. But I mean, I think that point I made about the lack of control over the situation, it's not, I think this is one of those things that you might have up on your wall, but, you know, worry about the things that you can control rather than the things you can't control, at least in terms of, or, you know, and you prepare for the consequences of things you can't control. But, you know, I think there is an element of the government is, and all of us would probably be better off sort of trying to focus on the things that we can really make a difference to. And that's the kind of things that Jonathan was just talking about, and that the, you know, the Chancellor, whose short-term forecast numbers have been sort of gone up in smoke over the last few months, you know, probably ought to still focus on, because it's that kind of long-termism that, you know, dare I say, has been the thing that's been rather missing in the last few years, even decades, some would argue. And, you know, one thing I think is a real cost to the environment we've had over the last few years, whether it's kind of political volatility or economic volatility, is that it makes it's hard enough for governments to do things that mean sort of short-term challenges and short-term difficult debates. You know, they have almost no capacity to do that if they're also constantly fighting fires. So I'm not sure that we're sort of unthinkingly optimistic, but we're just sort of, I think it's good if people can be focused on those sort of long-term elements of growth and the vital importance of growth in making all of these trade-offs much easier, and not always be thinking about what does it mean for the fiscal, you know, the buffers and the headroom and the, you know, what pressure is the Chancellor going to come under to help households. I think that does tend to distract from that much larger prize.
Jonathan, I mean, if I could come in on that. Sean, because I think, you know, again, Stephanie makes a valuable point. I mean, one way of thinking about this is that we've got institutions in place. I mentioned the Independent Central Bank before. I should also mention the Office of Budget Responsibility. We've got those institutions in place to sort of do the worrying for us, if you sort of see what I mean. You know, part of what people want to do is they don't want to be bothered by the intricacies of monetary policy or the intricacies of, you know, government financial accounting, and putting those strong institutions in place is a way of easing the cognitive load on people so that they can concentrate on growing their businesses and keeping their households going.
Jonathan, Stephanie, thank you for your time and your glimmers of optimism in there as well on this Easter weekend. We'll see if it still holds after the bank holidays all done. Jonathan Haskell there from the Imperial College Business School and Stephanie Flanders from Bloomberg.
Just flicking through the papers this morning at 12 minutes to 9, various of them leading on that story that we were talking about earlier in the programme. The Daily Telegraph talks about Iran shooting down its first American fighter jet. And as we were discussing, the weapons officer from that plane is still missing somewhere in Iran. The pilot was found and rescued, but there is a race going on at the moment to try and find that lost service member. You've heard in the bulletins as well, front page of The Sun this morning, "Can't Make It Up" is their headline. Armed police who were guarding the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, left a bag of guns on the street outside his home. They said there was a semi-automatic weapon in there, a Glock pistol, taser, ammunition. The paper points out that fortunately this was found by a passerby, a pregnant passerby, it says, who saw the bag and kicked it, actually, before telling her partner, who then collected it. But they make the point that the story could have been very differently if it was, could have ended very differently if it was found by a different group of people who might have chosen to use those weapons. The iWeekend this morning talks about Strava, the running app, popular running app. Their front page is that it's revealed the location of 500 military staff at British bases, apparently. They say that this is as well personnel in restricted areas, they say, routinely revealing their ID and their location on Strava. Since January of this year, so not long, just 4 months, the personal details of 519 individuals at sensitive British military sites have been posted. They say people are working at nuclear submarine base at Faslane, for example. Those details have been leaked. One who was traced to the exact submarine that they were deployed on as well. Apparently one route was jokingly called security breach by runners. So that's the front page of the iWeekend this morning. And just, I just wanted to mention the FT as well, the FT Weekend, just because there's a beautiful picture on there from Japan of a cyclist underneath the cherry blossom riding through there. It's a really lovely picture. The reason that beautiful picture is on the front of the paper is that police in Japan have started handing out fines this week to cyclists, because after years of being able to do exactly what they want on a bike, now they can't. They can't use headphones, ride on the pavement, leave bikes in parking spots that are reserved for elderly drivers. Now, it's fair to say, I think, that society in Japan is a little more rules-based than here, and I'm sure that people were probably, even without the rules, being a lot better behaved than people are in this country. But one thing that they don't have to do, even despite all of those rules coming in, says the FT, is wear a helmet.
Very interesting. Right, it's 9 minutes to nine. A masculinity crisis brewing in schools. Teachers' unions warning here about the ever-increasing consequences of the so-called manosphere, the network online that targets men and their struggles, often promoting misogyny along the way. A union survey of members found that misogyny from pupils in schools has risen for 4 years running. A quarter of female teachers saying they've received abuse of this form. I've got Professor Lee Elliott Major with us, who's a professor of social mobility at the University of Exeter. Good morning to you. And Joe Emmett, who's a teacher in Bristol, who started giving his students lessons around toxic masculinity. Morning, Joe. Joe, I just wonder what you have seen, your colleagues in particular, female colleagues have seen over the years, if this tallies with your experiences.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the shift is real and worrying. I mean, I've been teaching this issue for 20 years now, actually up in sort of Herefordshire rather than Bristol. But 20 years back, you know, I could teach around sort of sexuality and same-sex relationships, and some students would actually leave the room. Fast forward a decade later, and I had to almost kind of create sort of questions to get students to sort of think about these things, because people were so kind of accepting. But now, obviously, we've sort of returned to a clear challenging of issues around gender and sexuality and diversity. Thankfully, at my school, we have the time and I hope the staff training to kind of support sort of staff with this. But yeah, we can definitely see there's been as a response. We can see this is coming about from the sort of online influences, as we all know about the algorithms. It's feeding off the wider frustrations, the anger, the apathy, but it's definitely fueled and framed by a rebirth, I think, of worryingly political and monetized ideas around all of these issues, which I think has, you know, ended up even in banning books in libraries, for example. We can see that is all part of the same package, I fear.
Can you give an example, Joe, of how you've seen that portray itself in classrooms?
I guess, you know, I mean, thankfully I'm able to draw in sort of experts from outside, and we must sort of learn from those. So everyone's invited came in recently. I've worked with kind of Beyond Inequality. And in those sessions, when students, and this is the most important thing, that we come down to their level, are able to talk about what they see and understand online, you can clearly see that their algorithms, what they're watching at home, I would always worryingly say too much with not enough parent intervention, really, and too much time upstairs in their rooms, that they are coming out with issues and attitudes that I've really hoped would have disappeared sort of by now, but are definitely back. And so it's just that, yes, it's the insidious sort of comments that are made by some students who we would worry that are being influenced, you know, obviously by Tate and Co., but also, being honest, by Trump and others. It's all part of the same package. And so, okay. Yes, it does. It makes staff uncomfortable. I can see that. And I've heard enough with my union role as well of other schools where teachers are worried about what's
being said. I just want to bring Lee in here. Lee, from your perspective, Professor of Social Mobility, you know, how are you looking at this? What does this have to do with social mobility?
Well, there is a bigger story here, I think, which is that a lot of the societal challenges that we face inevitably play out in the classroom, right? So you're hearing Joe talk about, you know, thinking about tackling prejudice, you know, in the classroom, but they're increasingly, you know, my work with teachers, we're seeing many teachers act as de facto parents. You know, obviously trying to manage the huge crisis in additional needs that many pupils face. Plus, you know, my particular focus is, you know, poverty, hardship that presents itself at the school gates every day. And I think that, you know, a lot of people would say to me, you know, teachers should just, you know, focus on teaching in the classroom. The reality is, and you could hear this from what Joe was saying, is that a teacher these days is a counsellor, you know, a social worker, you know, poverty alleviator, and a guardian of you know, respectful values, all in one. And yet, I think we're incredibly harsh in how we measure schools and teachers, because we're effectively saying you've got to get the best academic results, almost as if these things didn't exist, right? So I think we really need to rebalance the system.
Are female teachers getting the support they need, Lee, when you say you work with teachers across this?
They are, but teachers are incredibly stretched, you know, because you'd need training for this challenge. For teachers, it's an incredible balancing act, because what you want to do is have clear expectations, right, in the classroom. But you're also trying to, you know, nurture relationships, deeper relationships with many of the pupils and parents who, you know, are really challenging the school system at the moment. You know, many children not coming into schools as much as they should do. So it was ever thus, but I think that the balancing act that teachers now face is more challenging than it's ever been before.
Professor Lee Elliott-Major from the University of Exeter, thank you. Thanks, Joe, as well. Joe Emmett there, teacher in Bristol.
A couple of minutes left on this morning's programme. It's 9:04. Time to talk about bison, a herd of bison that were brought in to help manage the habitat for wildlife at a nature reserve in Kent and are having a really positive impact. Alison Reuter joins us from the Kent Wildlife Trust. Morning, Alison.
Good morning, Anna.
You're the Wilder Grazing Lead, which I think is quite a cool title. It basically suggests that what they're doing here and how they're helping is that they're sort of roughing the place up a bit.
That's pretty much exactly what they do. Yeah, we really believe that if you let nature lead her own recovery with support, it creates an amazing habitat for lots and lots of biodiversity. And that's what the bison do. They come in, they change the habitats, they mess things up, they knock things over, they dig things up, they turn things around. And lots of wildlife really, really benefit from that.
And there's particular details. So I've just been learning this morning, knowing that I was going to talk to you about it. There are particular things about bison that mean that they're quite good at making more of a mess than a cow would be, for example.
Yes, so they have top and bottom teeth at the front, which cows don't have, which most people are really surprised to know. But it does mean they're really, really good at taking more woody, like tough, thick vegetation, because they've got the teeth for it. So they do bark stripping a lot more, and that kind of just taking some of the bark off the trees creates little folds in the bark that things like bats can roost in, like wood boring beetles can get into, things that are disappearing out of some of our woodlands because they don't have these kind of this messiness, this interaction.
That's really clever. And so you see the impact that they have, and that they're roaming more widely now than they were at the start. And then you can see, as you say, as you describe there, different types of wildlife moving in.
Exactly, yeah. Their weight as well, they're really, really big and they're very agile, so they can push into dense parts that maybe other animals wouldn't get into. That kind of opens up light to the woodland floor, brings to all those lovely wildflowers we're seeing at the moment coming through in the spring, and just creates more of that, so more things for pollinators, more spaces for reptiles to hide in the edges of those blocks that they start to sort of mosaic up. So we always say that, you know, more habitat you create, the more things can come in and use those different little niches, and that's what they do.
Yeah. Might there ever be a point at which it's too much? You think, hang on a minute, bison, calm down.
Absolutely, yeah, for anything. I mean, in a very, very natural ecosystem, you'd have a balance of kind of predators and prey animals. And although bison are really, really tough and they aren't really predated all that much, there would be still forces that would, natural life cycle things that would happen in nature that we just don't have in the UK anymore. So, of course, part of the high welfare programme would be that we would intervene and make sure that, you know, there's never too many or that they're never ill or injured in any way. So that's our job, is to come in. So it's nature-led recovery, but we're still here supporting them.
Yeah, that's really clever. Alison, thank you so much for telling us about it. That's Alison Reuter, who is the Wilder Grazing Lead at Kent Wildlife Trust, just describing there what that new herd of bison.